Members, we're going to get started. The policy committee will come to order. And I don't think we're at quorum yet, is that correct? So we'll hold off on doing formal stuff until we get enough members. Members, we have quite a few bills lined up for us today. As I mentioned last week, it'll be my intention to get through all of these bills today, which means that we will be reconvening later on this evening to finish the work. And we'll be reconvening at 6:30, and I believe we'll be in this room again later on this evening. I actually think we can move through these relatively quickly. Most of these bills, quite frankly, are bills that the chair is encouraging that we lay over for possible inclusion. And so part of what's happening today is for members to have an exposure to these bills, to be able to understand what's being proposed, and then to have a little bit more time to deliberate individually and in caucuses about them, and then come back next week and then make decisions about moving the bills forward or not. Let me do this. I'm going to call Representative Brown forward for House File 1212, and then we're going to do one of my bills and then Representative Winkler's bills. But before we do that, I want to speak a little bit about what I see the interrelationship between a number of these bills, so that the committee members can get a sense of the mad chair's thinking about these issues, sort of like the mad scientist thinking. But I just want to be able to frame up that there is a logic to the relationship of the interrelationship of a number of these bills. However, the Brown bill is sort of a standalone bill, and it's a good bill. And welcome, Representative Brown. We miss you on this committee, and let us know what we need to do to bring you, get you back on the committee at some point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is so nice to be here at committee again. Representative Robin Brown, and I do have House File 1212.
And Representative Brown, the chair will move. Can you hold on a second, please? Oh, no, I can't. All right. We can't move right now, so let's just, we'll start talking about the bill when we're at quorum, then we'll make the formal motion.
Sure. Just a little bit of background on this bill. This was brought to me this session, but it's kind of a continuation of something that we started last session. And what the bill is going to do is going to help, it's going to help us do our job as educators. I have a son that is severely hearing impaired, and the story behind that is, you know, we have IEPs in our education system, and we work with our teachers and our children to make sure that they're successful. Well, in my situation, I was always told that my son was doing just fine. He was doing just fine, and his report cards reflected that. His teachers' comments reflected that. But you know what I found out? As he got close to graduation, he wasn't doing just fine. He wasn't doing just fine at all. In comparison with his hearing peers, he was far, far below average. And what this bill will help do is get our educators information so that we can truly serve the deaf and hard of hearing population better, so that they can achieve at high levels. And they certainly can. We just have to have the data available to us to bring them to the level of education that they need. I have a couple of testifiers today, and we are going to keep it within our time. And if I could just turn it over to Dr. Susan Rose.
Thank you. Thank you, Kristen Brown. And Dr. Rose, welcome to the committee. It's our custom to have testifiers identify themselves by name and what they do, and then offer your testimony.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and thank you for allowing me to speak with you this morning. My name is Susan Rose, and I'm on the commission for the Minnesota Commission for Deaf and Hard of Hearing and Deaf Blind. I'm also a professor at the University of Minnesota and the coordinator of the Deaf Hard of Hearing program serving deaf and hard of hearing children. The centerpiece of this House File 1212 is accountability, which is an attempt to identify how we're doing in our roles as educators serving deaf children, infants, and youth across the state of Minnesota. This proposal values accountability from multiple perspectives. First and foremost, We're asking the question, are we as specialists in the field of deaf education making a difference? Are we doing our job? And how well are we doing them? The most recent data regarding the performance of deaf students in the state of Minnesota comes from a data file of 1996. That's more than a decade ago. And that was conducted by Gallaudet University out of Washington, D.C. Since that time, we've relied on the information from NCLB and statewide testing as an indicator of our achievement data in the state of Minnesota. While more than 80% of the students with hearing loss do participate in statewide testing, we have no results that can be used as indicators of achievement. Why is the testing being done if we can't access the data? We are spending approximately $30 million per year serving 2,400 infants, children, and youth with hearing loss. Are we getting what we pay for? Are those outcomes equivalent to the investment? Do we have a Cadillac expenditure program, or is this just meeting the bare necessities? A second perspective of accountability is, where are our children being educated, and how well are they doing in those settings? There are guesstimates of anywhere from 100 to 400 children and youth with hearing loss receiving their schooling in private schools, some at public taxpayer cost of $40,000 to $50,000 per year. Does this high-end investment yield greater academic outcomes? We really don't know. Currently, 28 of 50 states in the U.S. report outcome data for the purpose of accountability, as well as improving educational outcomes for deaf and hard of hearing students. Unfortunately, Minnesota is not among those 28 states. We are requesting that, like our neighbors in Iowa and Wisconsin, that the Minnesota Resource Center establish a valid and reliable system for reporting academic achievement and monitoring student progress of infants, children, and youth who are deaf and hard of hearing. And thank you, Representative Brown, for offering this bill.
Thank you, Dr. Rose.
And Mr. Chair, I have two more testifiers. If Tom Anderson and J.P. Wilson could come up and speak for a minute, that'd be great.
And Representative Brown, while we do that, I'm told that we are now at quorum, and so the chair will move that House File 1212 be recommended to pass. A few bills before us. Representative Brown, I'm also told that there's some technical, let's just hear from your specifiers, and then we'll deal with some of the technical language issues that one of our members will apparently discover here.
Okay.
So welcome to the committee, and if you could please state your name for our record and then offer up your testimony. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Anderson. I'm a parent of four deaf children and a foster parent of two other deaf children. I'm also on the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing People, and I'm also on the chair of the board for the Metro Deaf School Charter School in St. Paul. I have always wanted the best outcomes for my children, and as a parent, I want to be able to compare how my children are doing at the schools they're at with other programs in the state. I want to be able to compare them one-to-one, and I want to be able to see, what is the best approach for teaching my deaf children, because I want them to have the best possible education, and I can't get that information from anyone. Every program I talk to says, well, my program's the best, and so I can't get the information, and so that's why this bill is important to me. So we would like to get the results from the Minnesota Resource Center of how our kids are doing, so that I can know how my kids are doing compared to other kids statewide and whether we're meeting the goals or not. I want to make sure that the test results of my kids are good and comparable to those their peers across the state. So as a parent, I really need that information to help me understand. Hearing parents of hearing children are able to compare the results of their children, you know, with school districts and other school districts around the state, I can't. So we need some way to get that information from those testing results. Thank you very much for allowing me to give my testimony.
And thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Yes.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and offer your testimony, that'd be wonderful.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thanks for the chance to be here today. My name is John Wilson. I'm 17 and a junior at Becker High School, a small mainstream school in Becker. I'm in mainstream 10th kindergarten, so I'm good with speech with pathologists, separate kind of hearing teachers, and many interpreters over the years since kindergarten. I have high goals for myself. I plan on attending college, but I haven't decided which one just yet. But after graduating, I want to go off to college, major in political science and law, because after graduation, I want to go and become an advocacy lawyer, working with the National Association of the Deaf, working with deaf clients and helping them deal with their legal issues. And as a deaf lawyer, I'll be able to work with deaf clients without ever seeing you for interpreters. Sorry for putting your interpreters out of business. Sorry. My goal is for the deaf community and to improve all aspects of our educational system. If the system in place doesn't provide some sort of feedback, how do we know it works? For me, this system has given me a good basis, got up on my future career. But does this system work as well for all deaf students? We don't know until we pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, JT. It's good to have you here this morning. What year in high school are you again?
Junior.
Junior year. So I suspect that you are probably in line to take some of the college entrance tests this spring, ACT tests, is that correct?
Don't remind me.
This committee has lots of opinions on tests. But you will do fine, no doubt. Members, it's wonderful to hear from parents and students in terms of high expectations, and also it's quite wonderful to hear from a young Minnesotan who has a clear idea of what his professional calling would be. We wish you much luck, JP, with that.
Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we need to do the technical amendment, don't we?
Yes, indeed. And I believe our technician in residence, Representative Obermiller, might be behind the corrections that that are being offered pro bono, I believe, by Representative Obermiller. Representative Obermiller, if you can point out...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't want anyone to rely on me to catch these. I just happened to read them. I think in on line 1.8 that there's the word, extra word "and" at the very end of that sentence. And I'll actually defer to the author of it whether you want this to be they must offer summer institutes and other training programs or other training programs, but I'm not sure which.
Representative Brown, and I think you're also looking for some advice from...
I am.
So we can give you some time to think about that as well.
I believe there's another one as well, though.
Sorry?
Oh, it's the or.
It's technical.
Sorry. Okay, I think we may have the corrected language here. After conferring with some of the citizen advocates here.
Okay.
And I believe, just to move us along here, members, the motion would be to strike the word "and" "like," those two words on line 1.8. Oh, "like" is already stricken, that's right. So strike the word "and" on line 1.8. And then we'll flip the page over on 2.1, strike the word data regarding on line 2.1 and insert data-base. And then after the word outcome, strike of and insert the word for. And then on line 2.3, strike the words recommendations and. I think apparently that'll work, and so Representative Brown, and your testifier, you can certainly speak to that. If you do, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is Mary Hartnett with the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing, Minnesota.
Good morning, Ms. Hartnett.
Thank you. We actually wanted to provide more flexibility. The resource centers must offer summer institutes. We wanted it to be, or other training programs does give us the flexibility. We wanted them to have the flexibility. Right now it's just that they must provide summer institutes. We wanted the advisory committee to be able to give them the flexibility to determine whether or not a summer institute or other training programs for the year would be appropriate. So with that, I believe that four other training programs gives us that flexibility. So,
and the language, Ms. Hartnett, on page 2 then also accomplishes what you're hoping to accomplish here with this
one. Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. Thank you.
Very well. Representative Ulmer-Bueller, I guess this captures what you've captured.
Yep.
Very well. So, members, the chair will move a verbal amendment to strike the word and on line 1.8, strike the word data regarding on line 2.1, and insert data-base after the word aggregate. Strike the word of after the word outcomes on line 2.1 and insert the word for. Members? I'm sorry. And then in addition to that amendment, strike the word on line 2.3, recommendations and. Both two words. Members, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion adopted. So the House File 1212 as amended is before us. And Representative Brown?
After the testimony, sir, I just would really appreciate the committee's support on this bill so that we can make better serve our deaf students in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions, observations? Is anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Very well. If not, then, Representative Brown, we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Thank you for bringing the bill before us. Thank you, Ms. Hartnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee.
Okay. I'm going to ask Representative Katz if he would be so kind as to chair the committee while he presents file 1538.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And as you get positioned, I'll have you move your bill, which I believe we are asking that it be recommended to pass, and then laid over. So if you'd like to move that, and I believe you have an amendment before us as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 1538 be recommended to pass. And before I get going on this bill, I hope members received a handout that I had prepared early this morning. It's dated 318-209, and on the top, the title is, I have to come up with the title, so the title I came up with was Building Policymaking Capacity Proposals. And what I wanted to do, members, because we're going to be hearing several bills, and actually some of these bills we've already heard, but we'll be hearing several other bills that are interrelated in one way or the other. and I've identified 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 bills that in one way or another have to do with members' desires to build or sort of the nexus between building capacity in this legislature relative to our overall outcomes and goals in K-12 education and being able to access good advice from independent, meaning non-legislative, executive branch sorts, sources that would help guide our ongoing development and leadership of K-12 education in our state. A couple of these we've heard, members. A few weeks ago, we heard Representative Swales' P-20 commission bill, which would formally create the P-20, which now currently exists in an ad hoc manner, and would place legislators on that body. And as you know, that group of people have been, over the short few years that it's existed, have offered some advice and direction to all sorts of policymakers in the state, including, I believe, last year, a bill that resulted in an enhanced data sharing scenario for K-12 and post-secondary. We also heard just last week Representative Carlson's bill to reinstate, actually technically it's to create, but it is historically to reinstate the Minnesota State Board of Education, which at one time existed as a third party, if you will, entity that helped to set direction in the state for K-12 outcomes and then provided advice to both the executive and the legislative branch. They also had a number of technical management of education policy decisions in our state. We've got now several bills that we'll be hearing over the course of the next few days, and the intention of the chair is to hear these bills, have you understand what they're aiming to propose, think through how they're interrelated, but then also more importantly think through how these bills may meet your desires to be able to help set a perhaps clearer, more consistent environment in our state relative to legislature's ability to lead K-12 education policy. And so there's a bill that we'll be hearing later on this evening that I've introduced, a research center bill. The bill that I'll talk about in a few minutes here is an innovation fund bill. There's also Representative Benson and Representative Bly have introduced bills related to a kind of hybrid concept of creating new schools. Later on this morning, we'll hear from Representative Winkler's bill that flows out of the SMART framework, SMART framework developed by the Growth and Justice Community that went through at least a year-long statewide process of engaging various stakeholders, providing value-added, if you will, services to our K-12 community. And then there's a bill I won't be hearing, but it's a bill that I have been working with some other individuals, particularly the AMSD and Senator Rummel in the Senate, to create a commission on legislative, on the future of public education. So you can see that, and as you hear from these bills, there are strong interrelations and there are also very unique features of all of these bills. And for me, I think it's just sort of helpful to kind of get up to the 40,000 foot level and look out at the various proposals and one, be informed as individuals what you all as individuals but also as your colleagues are sort of struggling with and perhaps, trying to kind of envision in terms of next steps as a legislative body relative to providing leadership for K-12 education. And then we'll get down to the one-foot level and dissect some of these bills as well. So I offer this as a helpful tool to think about the bills that we'll be hearing over the course of the next few days. And again, it's my intention not to move any of these bills in this week, but to hear them and then solicit advice among ourselves so that as we put together our omnibus bill next week, we'll be able to forward what we think are some of the best ideas that flow out of these bills. So, Mr. Chair, with that, House File 1438, and I do have an amendment to that. It's actually a delete all amendment.
The A4 amendment, I believe everybody has that. If you would like to move that.
I do, Mr. Chair. I would move it. I would also ask the page to give me a copy of the amendment. I don't have it before me. Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Newton is our page today.
Yes, he is. And a wonderful page he is. 4 points.
It's a promotion, right?
Mr. Chair, members, this bill is meant to be a complement to the what we commonly know as the Minnesota Miracle Bill. We're introduced, I think it's House File number 2 by Representative Greiling. And as you all know, I'm not going to go through the Minnesota Miracle Bill itself, but you know, it does attempt to revamp, if you will, our funding formulas and distributions in K-12. So it's pretty big in that respect. And then also, of course, one of the bigger features of it is that it seeks to make a rather large infusion of new investments over and above our current investments in K-12 education that could be phased in or done at one shot over the course of the next few years. One of the components inside the Minnesota Miracle Bill is a piece that's called an innovation fund. And the thinking by the author of the bill is that piece would be kind of one of the major contributors to trying to drive some transformative changes in K-12 education so that we're not just simply in a position of being asked to put more money into the existing delivery system, but also to put more investments into a delivery system that can actually attempt to play out, if you will, to implement some strong innovative practices that then could lead towards some long-term transformative changes in the delivery of K-12 education. The Innovation Fund, as structured in the Minnesota Miracle Bill, sets aside 5% of the basic revenue for the purpose of innovation efforts. And the language in the bill currently is pretty short and pretty simple and straightforward. And so what this bill would do is to attempt to provide perhaps a slightly different approach, but also a little bit more fuller direction. And the principles behind it are several principles. One is that, of course, that we want to be able to encourage and reward trying new things. Two, that we are looking for a way to transform and update all of our delivery of education. So in other words, what I was struggling with is, you know, it's nice, if you will, to have an extra chunk of investment to be able to create, you know, efforts, but my experiences, or new efforts, but my experience is that often those new efforts get stuck, if you will, on the margins of our delivery system. And so the intent here is to be able to go ahead and have districts try those new efforts, but to be challenged to use those new efforts to, in fact, not leave them on the margins of delivery of instruction, but actually to transform the overall delivery of instruction. Another principle here is that, while not exclusive, that there is a targeting at addressing achievement gap issues. I like to call this the equity part of what I think should be our agenda in our state. I believe that we should have both an equity and a quality agenda, and I don't think they're mutually exclusive at all. And as you all know, I don't need to repeat, you know, we've got some huge challenges in our state in terms of providing equitable, producing equitable educational outcomes across certain student cohorts. Another principle then is to include driving quality outcomes for all students. I was very struck by Dr. Heitz's presentation yesterday when he walked through with us the growth model, the low, medium, high components of measuring growth, and that indeed the whole notion that you can indeed have students who are quite proficient relative to our standards, who nonetheless show minimal or no growth in learning. It seems to me that our challenges are just as equally important to drive ongoing learning among those students as it is making sure that we close gaps. Another principle then of the bill would be to have the public know about the use of innovation funds, to be able to track how it's being used and to be able to understand how progress is or isn't being made relative to those investments. And then a final principle here is to tie the innovation funds not just to any idea that the districts might have, but to tie them to high expectations that exist in statute. And so we set some minimum quality standards for the use of the funds that pertain to statutory language that we have, expecting reading by second grade out of our K-12 system, completing Algebra 1 by 8th grade by the year 2010, completing Algebra 2 by graduation by the year 2014, and completing chemistry and physics by courses successfully by graduation by 2014. So the language is structured so that all districts would submit plans. And why is that important for all districts to submit plans? I would argue that it's important for the public to know what the goals are and what the measurements are that districts would propose to indicate the movement toward those goals. We think it's important for every district, or for the public to know every district's intent relative to their goals and measurements. We also want to set up the ability to share effective practices across districts, and so submitting plans uniformly would allow us to, in essence, develop a database, if you will, of goals and measurements that, if we track over time, would allow for that sharing of practices. And then, frankly, to assure that the public, to assure the public that the legislature is, in fact, not simply, quote unquote, doling out money for existing K-12 system, but is, in fact, very interested in a primary way in driving transformation of our K-12 system across all districts. The department would then assure that that plans align with the law. As I mentioned earlier, there are some statutory goals that we identified, but my proposal isn't to have the department necessarily subjectively, if you will, deny or approve the plan as much as to assure that there is a legal threshold that's being met here by these plans, particularly relative to the statutory references. All plans then must include how to achieve ed equity in student outcomes, so that's that closing achievement gap. So we would want all districts to have that as a minimal, at least, component of their plans. And then all plans must identify how progress will be measured, including possible use of growth models. And I know that Representative Reiner and I have talked about this, and I believe you are correct, Representative Reiner, that we're still pretty much in the early stages of understanding the potentialities of using growth models for all sorts of purposes. And it's in the original language in the Minnesota Miracle Bill, we do a direct relationship to growth models as the primary way in which to measure progress and success. I am convinced that I think that needs to mature a little bit longer over time. However, since we're asking the districts to identify for themselves what their measures will be, I wanted to have language that indicates that to the degree that they're comfortable and able and willing competently to use growth models, that can certainly be one of the measures that they can identify to show their progress. All plans must identify how innovation can transform district programs and practices, so we want districts to tell us not only that they've got these great ideas, and Representative Farley and I were speaking the other day about, I think, a district that has a apparently an incredible or new and emerging incredible engineering focus program, and I got pretty excited hearing about it. But what I also want to know is, so how, what is it about that investment that then is driving changes in the delivery of that whole district, informing how it does that for all students, whether they're involved in that engineering program or not. And then finally, all progress is reported publicly. The final thing I'll say, and then I'll open it up for all sorts of observations and questions, is that I do think there's something missing here, and this gets at the issue of that I opened up with all these various ideas out here. I do think it's still important for us as a state, yes, to have a dynamic process that can interpret these plans, that can interpret what these goals are, whether they're intelligent goals, meaningful goals, whether the indicators that we're using are the best and appropriate indicators, and that can consistently, report progress back out to the public and to the legislature relative to these plans. Some folks might argue, well, you know, Representative Mariani, we've got NCLB, and to some degree NCLB sets up, the same kind of dynamics. And I don't want to get into a battle with the NCLB framework. One, I suspect strongly that framework is going to change within the next year or so. But whether it does or not, I think it's very important that we as a state assert our rightful responsibility in addition to conforming, if you will, with federal expectations, in addition to that we assert our authority, our responsibility to develop our own ways in which we can guide K-12 education, measure its outcomes and its efficacy, and then report that back to our constituents. And so I believe that strongly, regardless of whether we have an NCLB dominated accountability system or not. So members, that's the idea, and as I mentioned at the beginning, and Representative Greiling, I'll repeat this for you, because the idea here is eventually that these ideas will move forward to your committee. I don't think I've got all the bases covered here, and so part of what I wanted to make sure is that we're having some time to let these ideas settle in, and then next week we'll come forward and reshape them, if we will, and attempt to pass our best ideas forward to the K-12 Finance Committee. So with that, members, and Mr. Chair,
we do have a few questions, but before we do that, I don't believe we have officially moved the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would move the A4 amendment, and this is a... is this a delete all?
It is not.
It's not the line, page and line amendment, yeah.
Yeah, this deletes lines 8 to 15 and then inserts that.
Right. And Mr. Chair, members, this essentially puts the bill in the shape that I do want it to be in, and matches the testimony I just gave you. So I would move that, Chair.
Great. Well, let's vote on that so it puts it into the text that the author would like to have it in. So those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Questions? Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mariani and members. I really appreciate the work that Representative Mariani and now this committee is doing on fleshing out the innovation revenue section of the new Minnesota Miracle. And I think it's always been my favorite part of that bill. And I have two things one question and one suggestion. And my question is, and this is a change from the dynamic of the other bill in the sense that every district would do this plan, whereas in the original House File 2, the districts that are making progress based on
whatever the report card would be that we would decide on, would do the plan, and the others would not have to do the plan, and only those if the students weren't making progress would do the plan. It might end up at the rate we're going that, you know, this would be six of one and half a dozen of another. Maybe they'd all be doing plans anyway. But I just want to point that out to people that are here, that that is a big change. Mm-hmm. And so if people have input on that and think about it, hopefully as the bill progresses, you know, people can let us know. Mm-hmm. I kind of like the dynamic of your reward for doing well was to not have to do a plan, and otherwise you would. But I also kind of thought that would be almost everybody anyway. So I really like the components and focusing on the achievement gap. I think that's always been the intention. So I'm open to having this be the language, unless we hear feedback from people that, you know, that's something we should reconsider. And then my other question, and something that I did mention to Representative Mariani, and I see that it's not in here, and I wondered if you thought about it and decided not to do it, or just the timing of things. And that is the idea of having, when this plan is developed by the school district, having some language in statute that includes parents or the community, so that it's a bigger, because everybody has a stake in this achievement gap. And I just think every time we can, just like President Obama is doing, underscore that this isn't just the school's responsibility, it's also the parents have to do part of this as well. Either whether it's helping with school or doing their part at home or both, if you would be open to adding in some language that would include that as we move forward, that we could put in the next education finance stop.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, and members, and we have chatted about this. I almost cannot not chat with Representative Bradley because we're seatmates on the floor of the House, and that's a wonderful thing in my mind. But, I am open to that. I think it was really more two things. One, trying to continually develop a new frame and not getting around to those much more detailed positions. But then also, quite honestly, and I want us to think about this as well, and this is because I do share, and I understand the research, as you do too, about the primacy of strong parental participation with K-12 schools in order to produce high outcomes. I think the research is pretty clear about that. The only issue I struggled with then relative to that is to what degree do we want to be prescriptive to districts relative to different components of the plan. And I am certainly open that if we collegially feel that that is important enough for us to be prescriptive, then I'm comfortable with that.
Representative Adler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani, Representative Greiling, to the discussion. I have to apologize. Most of my brain has been filled up with human service stuff this last few months. I've got a bunch of ideas rattled around my head for this area, and I haven't written them down. I'm sorry about that. But and they may get written down yet, but I'll just keep rattling. But just to offer a thought here, I don't get to serve on K-12 finance, which I really miss being there. That was something I liked, just that the overlaps and you wind up being put into a niche. And so, but as this goes forward, I just want to encourage you, and Carlos has helped you on, I'm with you on some controversial pieces, and we have to help the kids. And but I hope as this moves forward that we can be real about it. The Senate proposed to spend $2 billion out of new money and cut K-12 billion, which I find flummoxing, in the words of Representative Greiling. Like, wow. And like, how could you do that? I don't understand politics behind that, but they did that. And the chance of getting $2 billion new revenue is a little slim, I would predict. And maybe, who knows, I could be wrong. But I hope that as we pass bills out of here, that we recognize the reality. And remembering a budget forecast for the pessimistic view from November is better than the baseline now. And we don't know where it stops at. And we heard from St. Francis District, which is barely able to, they're cutting because they can't pass a levy, and they're just in a turmoil up there, and Anoka cuts $10 million. And read the paper, it's a
an article today about who's having to retrench. And I hope that as we bring forward these proposals that you can have what you wish, and you're entitled to dream. But I hope you recognize that in this time that the school districts are the equivalent of a household trying to make their mortgage and pay the gas bill. And the vacation folders, and they want to go on a Tahiti trip, you know, keep wishing for the Tahiti trip, but the urgency is to solve the crisis needs. And if you talk to the districts, and I know we all do, and I'm just helping just to bring the discussion to where it will be in May and June, because I'm thinking end game here. And how do we help districts to survive? And these ideas, I think they're commendable, and but I hope that we can give the districts a package that they can actually apply to serve the kids better with what they have. And how do you help St. Francis? I don't represent them, but they're near to me. I understand their challenges. How do you help them with almost no levy revenue serve their kids in ways that are practical and doable? And I think it's at the end, you know, dream and get the boulders out, but at the end we have to give them something that they can pay their bills with. And I hope that that's just my encouragement to you, Mr. Chair and to Madam Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before Representative Growling responds, because I'm sure she would like to, but let me just say that Representative Abler has served well, capably and well and honorably in this body for a number of years. And so I know you served on conference committees in the end game. And for newer members, I think one of the things that's a surprising learning is that forget Republican versus Democrat. It becomes House versus Senate, you know, at the end, and it's really quite amazing sometimes. And so I suspect, while we're representing Riley, I'm just as flummoxed as you are relative to the Senate position. I can't think of a worse thing for society to do than to cut back at its investment in its next generation. And I do believe that the sacrifices that often are called upon us as a people to make, we need to make as the generation that had previous generation invest in us. Let me just say that I think one of the things that we're all struggling with in any area, I think, in this legislature is how do we not allow the very real crisis that we're facing economically as a nation and budgetarily as a state simply shut down our ability to think about a better tomorrow, to think about a vision for how we can do things better, more effective, more efficiently, with better outcomes. And I think a good chunk of what you'll find in this numerical bill and what you'll see in this, you see in this bill is an attempt to, you know, at the very least, put a placeholder on shaping that vision. And I think Representative Growling will probably tell you that the Minnesota Miracle Bill is not a all-or-nothing proposition. It isn't, you know, massive amounts of money today or nothing, that there are scalable components. And to the degree that we're able to scale any of those components out, I think it's incumbent on us to put those ideas forward.
Representative Greiling, your flummoxed response.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Abler, I will just say that, of course, the Senate plan is more than meets the eye when you look at the federal stimulus money, which the governor did plug in his bill number 2 yesterday. And the Senate plan was the bald plan without looking at those numbers. So we are still hoping that when they do, they will do a better job with education than what it appears. And you have to remember also that they proposed $2 billion in tax increases. So their budget balances, and they say they didn't do SHIP, in addition to not doing the tax anticipation borrowing. I don't know if that's true or not, because I haven't seen the details of their plan. I've seen some details, and then I heard their words, and Senator Pogemiller actually said it again in the paper today, that they don't have any shifts. So if that's the case, they actually, despite what we are looking at, may have put education in a better spot than the governor, who looks like he's increasing it yet again, but he really didn't balance the budget in the out years, and then there's all that shifting and borrowing. So I think the jury is still out on, you know, we all know that Senator Pogemiller is a very complex, sophisticated person, and in the end, they are not out of the game when it comes to education. In the House, we are still battling about our targets. They're coming out on Friday. If you notice blood all over some of us, you'll know we're battling very hard. And but I just want to say to you about your comments about the new Minnesota Miracle being a trip to Tahiti. I don't know if that's what you really meant. But I would say that, you know, properly and adequately and equitably funding our schools, I'm sure you didn't mean that was a trip to Tahiti, or that we want the accountability for that money spent that Representative Mariani is providing, along with others in the bills we're hearing today, for that, making sure it goes to student learning. To me, that is, in addition to health care, because I don't pit education against health care, and I know you don't either. I think that those are the core functions of a family, and why we work and you know, have money there is to have a healthy family and an educated family. And these aren't frills, they're not trips to Tahiti. They're the main thing that we sit around the kitchen table for. So we can dream, and we should dream, and it should be to have healthy children and children that get proper educated educations wherever they live, so they can graduate ready for success, which is a meat and potatoes thing, not a trip to Tahiti.
Mr. Chair, we do have the Winkler bill, and I want to make sure we have enough time to hear from him and his testifiers on it. It's not a simple bill, and so I want to make sure we belong here. I do want to just say, again, Representative Abler and others, we're not moving this bill today. The idea is to respect. If you have ideas to offer on how we might be able to say the offer is more than open, doing that, and we'll vet that out next week as we amend the policy bill.
Representative Abler, yeah, about your trip to Tahiti.
No, I'm actually going to talk. I'm going to sidestep that whole thing, and we'll chat in private about where we wish we were going, where I wish I were now, Mr. Chair. But just to add in the debate about why not cut education and why cut human service, why not cut, you know, I just want to remind people in the human service budget that the forecast goes up 23% or so. The forecast in education goes up 0%. And so, just as why would we leave the K-12 intact, which is my vote, by the way, and do some management, which I'll call it, in the human service world, which I'm working hard on, to soft land everybody the best we can. That would be just the point to bring up, and that seems to be lost in the discussion. So as we talk about that, remind people that there's no built-in inflation in K-12.
Great. Thank you, Representative Abler. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick things. I'm all for innovation. I think that's a good thing. However, a couple of my children survived some experiments in education, which I'm nervous about that. When you say innovation, sometimes leads to some ideas that that aren't exactly successful. This also sounds strange, like a mandate, but I won't go there either. The question I've got, I have a school district that's in statutory operating debt. How would this impact a district in that situation?
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norgis, I think to fully answer that question, we need to talk about the entire Minnesota Miracle Bill. And I suspect that the answer from the author of that bill is that that bill will help districts like yours, the FNSLD, be in a better position relative to finances than what is currently happening in terms of how we economically structure resources for districts. And so I don't think that the Innovation Fund is the answer to that. I think the Innovation Fund is really the answer, or an answer, to transforming the delivery of education beyond what we're currently doing. And I also want to say that I'm very mindful of the fact that what we don't want to do is just create all sorts of willy-nilly ideas. We should not be experimenting with our kids. Absolutely not. The language here calls on the application of evidence-based practices that are informed by research. There is guidance relative to the expectations that we set in statute, the high expectations, and then the achievement gap closing goals as well. So if we need to tighten that up so that we're not creating, something that looks like experimenting irresponsibly, then I am certainly open to language to do that.
Representative Demmer. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. I'm not going to go into the other stuff we talked about, even though I'd like to. But to bring back to this particular legislation, I agree that we do have to stay balanced as we look at education. We can't simply look at what are we going to do tomorrow or next week. We also have to be looking at vision long term. There has to be balance in that. I understand the needs of today, but I also understand the needs of looking forward, and I think that helps today. And quite frankly, I'll mention again a bill that I have that we're going to be hearing in K-12 finance tomorrow and Friday morning in this committee regarding achievement grants and the Baldrige criteria and the Minnesota Quality Council. I think it fits very well, Representative Mayani, with what you're looking at here. And quite frankly, I appreciate Representative Norris's comments about another new program. I think that is a framework that gives us some sort of vision as to how we can go forward. And there's some synergy here between what you're trying to accomplish, I think, with this bill and the vision of working through the Baldrige criteria and or working with Minnesota Quality Council and looking at quality moving forward in our school systems in a coordinated and within a framework that is something that makes some sense without doing the latest and greatest idea that we come up with here. So I look forward to how this all fits together. We have some interesting pieces, Representative Mayani, and thank you again for hearing that Friday morning, and Representative Reiling also for tomorrow. I think it fits in very well.
And Mr. Chair, very quickly, I think we should add that as an H underneath this list as a possibility. We don't have a bill in our committee, but nonetheless, I think Representative Demmer is correct that there's a nexus here in terms of the kind of incentives that we can help create that can further innovation.
Representative Downing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Mariani. You can respond to this or not. I appreciate we're moving this forward for possible inclusion, and it's a discussion starter in many ways. But on point three, in terms of the particulars of the plan submitted by the district, the first line says that the plan should demonstrate how the innovation revenue would narrow and eliminate differences in achievement between these groups. And I think eliminate would be almost an impossible standard, especially if we're including special education subcategories in there. And also just maybe an overall comment that if the focus is to narrow and eliminate, one could argue that would most easily be done by leveling. And I think it's more an advancement of those other groups as compared to perhaps just narrowing the gap. So maybe just a little clarity around how we actually increase the achievement as compared to simply narrowing the gap.
It's a very good observation. I kind of made that observation when Dr. Heifetz made his presentation the other day relative to gaps also being created by what's happening with our proficient students, whether they're moving rapidly forward or not. We did struggle with this language because we also acknowledge that innovation funds alone probably are not going to narrow and eliminate differences. And so the idea here is how do we circle back to the notion of using innovation funds as a transformative agent that can then inform and impact the application of the majority of our resources, compensatory aid, as well as some of the other categories and then the rest of the basic revenue. So I'm certainly open to working with you and committee members on how we can tighten that language to be much more clear and much more realistic about what we can do with that.
Representative Benson.
Just a quick note on that item three. You do have the word help in there.
Yeah.
So I think that qualifies.
Yeah, we were looking for qualifying.
We
were looking for a way to qualify.
Would you like to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we lay the bones for possible inclusion in, on those policy bills. And I thank the committee members for their wrestling with this and look forward to continue working with you over the course of the next several days so that we can continue to shape this concept.
Representative Mariani renews his motion to lay over House File 1538 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Winkler, if you'd like to come down with your testify. Chair moves House File 1188 to be recommended to pass and recommended to move on to, oh, laid over for possible inclusion in the K-12 policy and oversight omnibus bill. Representative Winkler, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is, this should not be called the Winkler bill. It should be called the Growth and Justice Bill. Many of you have seen the Growth and Justice Report, Smart Investments in Minnesota Students. With me is Angie Eiler, the author of the report. And I think that the best way is for her to go through the vision and the parameters and the goals that the report contains, and then I can try to explain how we did our best to translate that vision into bill form that we could begin to, so that we could begin to move towards implementing what they're talking about. So I think that we can start with Andy.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead. Do all members have the handouts from Growth and Justice? Okay.
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Angie Eilers. I'm the Research and Policy Director at Growth and Justice. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before this committee this morning. And I'll try to be brief in the interest of time and courtesy to hear the other bills. To begin, we start with a strategic goal, not unlike any other wise investment plan. We are taking a very long-term approach, by the way. We're looking out to the year 2020. And by that year, we'd like to see the increase of the Minnesota students who hold a post-secondary degree of any kind, a one or a two or a four-year degree, to increase by as much as 50% from the level it is today. On slide three, the explanation for that ambitious goal is based primarily on our projected demographic changes. Currently, today's student cohorts from ages of 24 to 35, there are a total of about 52% of students who hold a two-year or a four-year degree. If we do nothing in Minnesota between now and the year 2020, that combined total of two- and four-year degree holders will shrink back to about 38%. That's moving our students in the wrong direction to take advantage of and contribute to a more competitive and globalized economy. On slide four, you can see where the our state's demographer has projected the changes in our student population. The white population and the upper income population of the state have historically been the degree holders and post-secondary level in the state, and that population is projected to grow at about 7%. We're seeing an exponential growth in the rate of students of color who have not historically benefited from our post-secondary systems, and we'd like to change that. We'd like to prepare our students to be ready for and to acquire a post-secondary degree at the level of their peers. On slide five, you can see that in order to hit that 50% attainment goal, we're going to have to see an aggressive and upward kicking of those who hold degrees. For example, for every 100 African-American students who hold a two-year or a four-year degree today, by the year 2020, we're going to need to see an additional 150 students for a total of 250 African-American students who hold a degree. Similarly, for our Latino population, for every 100 Latinos who hold a two- or a four-year degree today, we'll need to see 250 to 275 more students, for a cumulative total of 375 students. So there's quite a lot of work to do. Excuse me. We're in the same boat.
We are.
So the question is, in order to reach that goal, which, by the way, positions our individual students and our larger economy in a position of greater growth, where should we best invest and how? And we mapped out this problematic question by mapping backwards from the end goal. Knowing that we want to increase the post-secondary attainment rate, we have to look in the pathway of students along the way. And I've shaded the statutory requirements in light blue. You can see that based on state statutes and a reflection of the No Child Left Behind Act, that we'll want to see all of our students reading at the third grade level. We'll want to see all of our students take and pass Algebra 1 in the eighth grade. Our high school students will need to take and pass Algebra 2, Chemistry and Physics, and other rigorous coursework. It's not statutorily required, but I think everyone recognizes the cognitive benefits that when children are ready for kindergarten, they're more likely to be reading at the third grade level. So then the issue is, how many of our students are currently achieving those benchmarks? How many of our students are ready for K? We know that approximately half can be indicated that they're ready for kindergarten. Our third grade reading proficiency levels are not anywhere where they ought to be in order to have all students reading at the third grade level. Our students are currently taking algebra in the ninth grade. We're going to be moving them down to the eighth grade. And even in taking algebra in the ninth grade, they're not all proficient in mathematical reasoning skills, etc. So knowing where our students are at in these outcomes, and I've given you a few snapshots here in the bar charts of using NAEP data, which, by the way, is more more accurately correlated with proficiency and the likelihood of taking and passing rigorous coursework later on. Knowing where our students are at, or where they are not, rather, there are several students, hundreds of thousands of students, tens of thousands of students who are not on track to achieve these benchmarks, then the question becomes, how are we going to get them there? And we recognize the austere times in our Minnesota economy and the national economy. So we applied two strict principles when we tried to answer the question of how to best meet those benchmarks. One, what are the proven practices? What can we say with confidence will make the difference for these kids? What will move the needle from being off track to being back on track? And two, what are the most cost-effective practices going through this? There are many programs out there that are either promising or innovative, but I think we need to have a little bit more confidence with our taxpayers' dollars and apply the proven practices. And furthermore, I think we need to ask about the price of these things. That's a factor that often eludes us. How much do these things cost, and in the long run, will we get the benefit cost ratio that's favorable? What I've outlined here on slide 10 are the number of proven practices that our meta-analysis of research from birth to college has teased out using those two strict filters. Those things that have been proven effective, in other words, they're shown to move the kids from below proficiency to proficiency or above, and that that's something that the state of Minnesota can afford. And we've mapped out interventions from birth, actually starting prenatal care, to transitioning to higher ed, those programs that will transition students and afford them to be able to enter and finish a post-secondary degree program. On the following slide, slide 11, there is another list of promising, meaning that they're either proven effective but don't have a cost analysis, or they are under review and are showing early evaluative results that they are effective interventions. We can say with confidence that any of these investments would be smart in making in advancing our students' progress toward a post-secondary achievement goal, or if even at a minimum, to get them at their proficiency level. And in quite a bit more detail on any and all of these programs, they've been reported at great length by scholars from around the country. All of these full academic papers can be downloaded from our website at growthandjustice.org. But furthermore, I calculated the number of students who are not at the proficiency level times the cost of these programs, the students who could benefit from these programs, and tallied up the cost, which is what these three colorful spreadsheets are to indicate to you, that if we were to afford ourselves the next smart investment in our students, we would argue that they would be in these particular areas, the students that have been identified who would benefit from them most, and it's an investment that we think we should afford ourselves. If not today, certainly over the course of time, so that we can hit a post-secondary attainment rate of something more like 75% of our students rather than 52% today. They can no longer make a living wage in Minnesota with just a high school diploma. They're going to have to get something beyond high school, a 1, 2, or 4-year degree. And if we do nothing, unfortunately, we'll move backwards to more like 1 in 3 students who have a post-secondary degree. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would just, I don't know if you want me to go through the bill or I want to take questions of the report, but the only additional context I'd like to provide on the report is that this is part of a larger growth and justice policy and budget analysis, and these numbers add up to roughly $1 billion a year, which is obviously significantly more money. It is also across the entire education spectrum, so it's as you say, birth through college or some kind of post-secondary education. But the overall growth and justice model looks at the ultimate end of getting state government on a sustainable basis at about a 17% price of government number, which if you look at historical averages going at least to the early 90s is about average for where we have been. Minnesota is now significantly below that. I think that's the relevant measure, how much out of every dollar that we have in income is going towards government at all levels. And if you look at making additional investments and thinking that we're probably not going to be moving it up radically over that kind of number, we have to say that our priorities, our resources are limited. And if we're focused on economic health, economic opportunity, and quality of life, then a major part of that should be in the total education system. And so I'm very supportive of this initiative, in part because it puts it in the context of our economy, of our budget resources, and what we need to do to realign existing programs and add additional funding in order to achieve a concrete goal that can be predicted and measured and has relevance to larger policy goals that we have as a state. I don't know if you want to discuss the report and the vision or move on to the bill. But
I believe we can move on to the bill if there's some context within this that you'd like to highlight, and then we'll open up to questions from members.
Mr. Chair, the bill is actually very simple. It's a lot of words and a number of pages, but basically what it does is create an E16 advisory committee to look at all existing programs and funds that we have in the education system, again, from birth through 16, and to create a series of subcommittees dedicated to each of the components in the Growth and Justice Report. And so the subcommittees then look at what we have, examine based on the research that Growth and Justice and others may provide, at other programs out there in the country or in the world that are working, and identify how we can realign and then add additional programs and prioritize funding with, again, the vision of having another $1 billion with which to do that. So the idea is we're not going to be prescribing exactly what the programs are based on this report, because what we have is essentially a framework for looking at these issues. What the work that has not been done is applying that framework directly into decision-making in policy and finance. So the basic structure of the bill is to task a group of people to go out and look at what we have, look at what has been done successfully elsewhere, and redesign a system that would deliver on these goals, again, with a 50% increase in post-high school degree attainment and another $1 billion per year to spend. And so essentially that's what the bill does.
Questions from members? Representative Adler.
Thank you, and I talked to Winkler about this. There's an oral amendment I'd like to offer, if he's still friendly to that. And I'll give you the amendment, and I'll tell you why it's a nice idea. On line 114, and line 115 would be the same amendment to strike the 3 and the 1 on each line and insert 2 in each spot. And if the members understand that, I'll describe it. Task forces and working groups come and go, and you want their recommendations to be credible and lasting. If you've noticed how when power changes, lots of heads change at the departments and lots of policies suddenly shift overnight, both in Washington and everywhere you go. And the more thought through and the more collaborative and, real the conclusions are, the more they stand the test of a regime change, if you will. And so this would help this group to be bringing forth quite credible results. I think that we all desire the outcomes they seek, and how you get there is another question, but that's the amendment.
Representative Adler moves an oral amendment that would strike on lines 114 and 116, 3 and 1, and replace them with 2. Which then I believe shall consist of, we need to change that to 10.
No, it's
the same number? So we're good. We're all right with numbers.
This is fairly, just highlights the importance of math proficiency.
Representative Newton to the amendment. Six of one, half dozen of another. Creates 12. Yeah. So it does say it's 12. Any other conversation or discussion on the amendment?
I consider that a friendly amendment.
You consider that a friendly amendment. All right. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Thank you.
Amendment prevails. To the bill. Any other discussion? Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, members, just a small observation on line 113. The Oversight Committee, consisting of Commissioners of Education, Finance, and Human Services, in addition to elected officials. We about 10, 12 years ago, Representative Gravelin, we went down this road, and I thought it was a good road, frankly, when then-Governor Arne Carlson proposed the creation of the Children, Family, and Learning Department as an attempt to reconstruct, in my opinion, to evolutionize in a similar fashion here, our approach to how we develop our young people in our state, and to really get at those issues of silos, if you will, that often get in the way as much as lend forward progress. So I'm really pleased to see this particular provision here bringing to the table major key players that are at the gateways of major investments that encompass the entire life of our young Minnesotans. So I just wanted to acknowledge and affirm that that direction in the bill.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank Representative Winkler for bringing this forth, and Ms. Ellers for all the research she's done on behalf of the children of our state. But one concern I have, and I don't know that we necessarily need to specify it in the bill, but there are a range of other councils and groups who are engaging these endeavors as we speak, whether it's the P16 Council or Early Childhood Council or, throughout the state, who are really driven to move in a research-based manner on behalf of the well-being of our children. And there's this trade-off between larger umbrella oversight councils and very small targeted endeavors that can actually work on the ground and make changes. And I would be concerned that we're careful about what the interface is here and that we honor the work that's actually going on currently.
Mr. Chair, Representative Briner, I think you are absolutely correct. The goal here is to have an overarching advisory council and then subcommittees under each of those. And my thought would be that each of the subcommittees would spend considerable time working with, they're going to be just largely the same people, is the idea, that you're going to have the same people who are looking at innovative ways of improving early childhood through the structure that Representative Peterson helped create, and perhaps the P16 Council, et cetera. But the people who are doing a lot of this work are probably going to be the same ones who would be involved in this. And so, the goal is to integrate those ideas and bring stakeholders together for the purposes that Representative Abler mentioned, which is to actually have something that will stand on its own. And the final piece, I guess, is I think it is, however, very important to have an overarching structure, because it isn't going to work ultimately with this ultimate goal if you don't have people who are crossing over these sectors and can look at transitions from early childhood into third grade, for example, on the literacy piece. If we don't bridge that and have some people looking at how we bridge it, and also looking at the details within each of those sectors, I think it's going to be hard to do exactly what you said, which is to honor the good work that's being done already.
Any discussion? Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if the Commissioners of Education, Finance, and Human Services have been talked to about this possibility and how they reacted to it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farland, I have not spoken with them about their desire to serve on an advisory. my presumption would be that if the bill is passed and signed into law by the governor, the governor will speak for them and say that they would be pleased to participate.
Mm-hmm. Further discussion. Representative Mariani.
Sir, I just want to thank Ms. Eilers for being here, but also for sharing cough drops with me this morning as we walked in. We're suffering under the same, apparently the same conditions this morning. But seriously, I do want to thank the work of the Growth and Justice community. We didn't really get a long time, obviously, to talk about the full engagement that your community of people have been involved in a very collaborative way across our state for well over a year. And so, members, rest assured that they're there has been a good deal, very strong vetting of the framework that then produces the bill that we have before us. I just want to thank the Silers and Growth and Justice for the work that they've done over the course of the last couple of years.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. If I may, I'd like to make a closing comment or observation. I appreciate the work of this committee, and I particularly appreciate the fact that you've been very intentional in bringing in and drawing on research, and I applaud you for that. And I'd say, if nothing else, if we could leave one trace as a result of the nearly 2 years of the work of the Smart Investments in Minnesota Students proposal, it is the following, and I think it brings together many of the seven bills that you have before you. And that is four principles that we try to focus on. That say, policy decisions are research-based and have shown a decent effect size, have been tested longitudinally with a large sample size, that these are not just case studies or anecdotal stories about programming, but to bring to bear effective research. Two, that there's a cost analysis done so that we can feel confident with taxpayer dollars that we're getting a greater bang for the buck. And three, that the policies are very comprehensive, that they represent the academic, social, and financial needs of students. And fourth, that they are holistic and that it reaches across the sectoral differences between pre-K, K-12, and higher ed. Today's three-year-old is tomorrow's third grader, is tomorrow's 13-year-old, and then a 13th grader, if you will. So I hope that our policies will be very comprehensive in that regard. And it seems to me if we attend to those four principles that many of the bills, everything from the research center to the advisory councils to the innovation funds, a variety of different things sort of seem to gel around those shared principles. And that's our takeaway set of principles from this research proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. The chair further moves that this that House File 1188 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And if I could get Representative Murdoch, would you be willing to move the minutes from our March 12th and March 17th meeting?
I'd be more than happy to. They look fine. Where are they?
Representative Demmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Say a quick comment. I've said this in other years, but this is outside the realm of what we do here, but I want to put in a word for the pages and the work that they do organizing our stuff, these green sleeves. This is so cool. I just am able to come in here and I'm organized, and I just want, I've said this in the past and I want to just say it again. I know they put a lot of time and effort into this. It does not go unappreciated from this member. I can come here and, as you know, we're in and out and we're all over the place, and I can get caught up relatively quickly with my organization. I just want to put a public word in for the pages and the work they do in organizing our paperwork for us. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a motion to approve the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And we stand adjourned till in recess till this evening, 6:30 p.m.
Members, the K-12 Policy Committee will reconvene. We've been recessed since this morning, and I apologize to fellow members and to the public. It had been my hope to reconvene us a little bit over an hour ago, but you know, the nature of the beast here sometimes means that your best laid plans often get delayed. I really appreciate the patience of the public and also of the members. I particularly appreciate our GOP members, because my DFL caucus was using this room. The good news is at least the seats are warm. Members, we have three bills, and we can go as quickly or as slow as you want to through them. I'm here. I'm seeing a vote from Representative Murdoch on that question. I will certainly. One of them is mine. I will certainly cut my testimony short, because it's a pretty simple bill. First off, we have Representative Simon, House File 575, and the chair will move that House File 575 be recommended to pass. And Representative Simon, we had started the day thinking that this bill, or the plan was that this bill will go back to the Transportation Committee. I've been informed by our K-12 Finance Committee that they do want to see the bill. And so as long as the bill is residing within the education stream, it seems like we should keep it there. And then hopefully if the bill does move out of this committee, hopefully then continue to move it over to where the author eventually wants this bill to be. My understanding is the K-12 Finance wants to be able to look at some fiscal issues, and hopefully they can do that relatively quickly. And Representative Simon, I believe you have an amendment. Would you care for me to move that amendment
at
this point?
If you wouldn't, Mr.
Chair. Representative Simon, the chair and members, the chair moves the H-0575A4 amendment. And Representative Simon, is this a delete-all amendment?
It's not a delete-all.
It is not a delete-all amendment. The amendment nonetheless puts the bill in the shape that you want it to be. So members, if we can extend that courtesy to the author, I would greatly appreciate it. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House File 575 is before us as the author wishes it to be before us at the same time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, at this late hour. I really appreciate your attention and your work on this committee. House File 575 is a way to provide an effective, popular, and safe option, and it is only that, an option, to kids in Minnesota who are learning to drive.
Representative Simon, I apologize for interrupting. I'm told that we were not able to get the correct engrossment of the bill from duplicating, so there's sort of a logistical issue here, and I don't want members to be confused, and obviously this amendment is... that we just adopted is to the first engrossment of the bill. Is that correct? So our staff is tracking that down for members, but obviously you'll explain the totality of the bill, and then we'll have the proper instrument before us.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. And again, this is a bill. It's been around now. This is its third session. And it's a way to provide an effective, popular, and safe alternative or option, and it is only that, just an option for kids in Minnesota who are learning how to drive. This only, I have to emphasize this, only applies to the permit portion, the in-class instruction portion of the driving education in Minnesota, not the behind the wheel. Of course, you need to actually take behind the wheel, behind the actual wheel with an actual driving instructor. But all this would do is add as an option, only as an option, for the 30-hour classroom in class portion, an improved internet online course that is approved by the Department of Public Safety. And again, we're not talking about the we're not talking about behind the wheel. We're only talking about the 30 hours. Now, in Minnesota right now, after age 18, there is no training whatsoever needed. You just have to take the test. And about a third of kids in Minnesota actually do this, or about 65,000 kids per year. But right now in the United States, about a third of the states have this system where it's only an option. Again, right now in Minnesota, there are two ways that you can do your permit test and take that 30 hours. One is in school, and one is at a private driving academy. I took mine at AAA in St. Louis Park, so I didn't do it through the school. But we seek to do what about a third of the states, actually more than a third, now have, which is to add an online option. And it is only that, an option. No parent or no kid need choose that option. So states like California, Florida, Texas, and many others, about 12 states, have that right now. So let me just give you a little bit of the procedural history, member. This passed with overwhelming support last year, or 2 years ago, I should say, out of both Transportation Committee, Policy, and the Finance Committee. And at the end of the session that year, it was decided that we would do a compromise. We would basically end the bill, but in exchange, what we would do is we would commission a study from the Department of Public Safety on what other states had found, or as the case may be, not found, with respect to their online driver's options. And so we also agreed as part of that that this year, even though in the as far as we know, in the history of driver's ed bill, the education committees, neither of them have ever had jurisdiction over the bill, we decided that because Chair Mariani and others wanted to see it, and that there's obviously an educational component, that we would come here to the Education Policy Committee, even though its ultimate goal would be to be back in the Transportation Committee, which has traditionally had jurisdiction over this area. So you have in your handout several materials, and I'm not going to repeat them or belabor the point because I don't want to bury you even more with paper. But on page 17 of that report that I just mentioned, it says, quote, Department of Public Safety does not necessarily view the lack of research as a barrier to the implementation of internet-based driver education in the state. Minnesotans are accustomed to breaking new ground. And then on page 19, quote, upon examining internet-based programs in 12 states, EPS found no evidence to date indicating whether teens who receive internet-based instruction are more or less likely to commit traffic violations or to be involved in crashes. End quote. So obviously safety is number one here. And again, 12 other states have this already. The Department of Public Safety already has curriculum content standards for existing driver's license courses, and they would simply apply those to this. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the amendment, because, again, I want to stress that in all its prior hearings this year and 2 years ago, this got overwhelming support in the Transportation Committee. I want to thank the co-authors, Representative Leader, Zellers, Newton, Holberg, Houseman, and others. And that's when we proposed doing it statewide. But we've talked to many of you on this committee and many in the community, and we've decided that for the sake of compromise, we're willing to do something different to allay any concerns or fears people have, and that's what the amendment does. The amendment goes from statewide to saying that we'll do a pilot project in two counties over the next 2.5 years, followed by a study, again commissioned by the Department of Public Safety, to look at traffic records and to look at crash rates. And that study would cost the state no net dollars. It would be funded entirely by an assessment on those who are actually doing the internet courses. Not the students, rather, the providers of the courses. And so those providers are willing to pay that per head fee to the Department of Public Safety. Now, in your handouts as well are some letters, and I'm not going to read from those or even excerpt them, but you'll see there's one from Minnesotans for Safe Driving. There are some from actual students who talk about how this has been a great way for them to learn these courses. You know, Representative Benson couldn't be here tonight, but he authorized me to tell you, he wasn't feeling good, but he authorized me to tell you, as he's told others on this committee, that he supports this bill, and he taught driver's ed in the Edina Public Schools for many, many years. And he supports this bill. And, you know, the bottom line for me and for many people in the other committees was this. There is always the backstop of the state test. You can't pass the test if you don't know the material, the Fermat test after the 30 hours. You can't pass that test, and you won't pass that test. And so even if the course is theoretically not working for that particular student, they're not going to learn the information, and they're not going to pass that test. So that's the ultimate backstop. And, of course, then to get their full license, they have to take 6 hours of behind the wheel. And so this is just providing an option. Only an option, only a menu item for students in the state of Minnesota to support. And as I say, it's been safe, effective, and popular in other states, particularly in rural areas. Because obviously the round-trip mile to drive a kid to driver's ed so they can take their permit test, that's asking a lot of some families. And this has been a great way for kids to learn at their own speed and derive certain benefits. You'll see in your handout as well, and you can read for yourself, I don't need to repeat for you, some of the features and benefits of online driver's ed. And again, as I say, over a third of the United States currently lives under this regime. But I want to share something with you members, because I understand the import of doing something here that's different. We're going to an online educational component, and that for some people might seem scary or hasty. I'd like, if you could, to look at the back of the handout that says features and benefits. And you look at a handout that I've shown to people, and this is telling, I think. And what this handout shows is that in the MinSU system right now in Minnesota, believe it or not, you can learn how to be a driver's instructor online right now. You can learn how to teach it to our 15 and 16 and 17 and 18-year-olds. So we already permit the people who are teaching the kids how to do this to learn online. So I want to emphasize, given all the other states that do this, and given that we are really scaling back this effort to make it two counties and a pilot program followed by a self-funded study, that we're not trying to foist upon people anything that's scary or radical or really out of the ordinary now, given how many other people have done it around the country, but we're trying to give kids and give families an option, and it's only that, an option. And I anticipate today you're going to hear from really good-hearted people who oppose this bill, who are worried about safety, and who say you absolutely always have to have a teacher in the classroom to learn this objective information that's on the driver's test. But I would say this, all of what you're going to hear, I predict, because I've heard it many times, is an excellent argument for why you would want to have your kid take a driver's ed course with a teacher. There was a great argument for that. It's not a good argument for why kids shouldn't even have the option, not even have the option of what a third of the United States has, to do it online with this course. Now, because people can't be in more than two places or more than one place at once, not two places at once, you aren't getting the benefit today of the presentation that other committees have gotten by one person who's involved with one of these folks who seek to offer it in Minnesota, which is an outstanding, I think people would agree, presentation on the merits of the actual system from a pedagogical standpoint. In terms of how some kids learn differently, they don't learn well, as you know far better than I, because you're on the committee and I'm not. Some kids learn far differently, and far better even, online, particularly with objective information, like what's the difference between a white line and a yellow line, and how should you approach an intersection, and who has the right of way. Some people learn far, far better that way than they would in a class. I can tell you, without any disrespect to AAA, because I think I'm an okay driver, when you're in the back of that classroom, as I was, in an ungraded, AAA non-school course, let's just say I wasn't always paying attention either. And I don't think I got, because of myself, not because of anyone else, 30 hours worth of real instruction either. I was writing notes to my friend. I was, listening to my Walkman. I was doing other things. And that's not to say everyone does. The one thing I want to really emphasize are the security features here. And he can do it more justice than I can, and he's not here. But in terms of the security features, many of you may be asking yourself, well, what's to prevent the neighbor kid from coming over and doing this for a particular student and just taking the course for them? Well, as Mr. Sifrin explained from driversed.com, that's very, very unlikely given the many security features that you can read about for yourself. There was some testimony in a prior committee about how one person over in the Senate claims to have gone online and taken the course and done something like 10 hours within a half an hour. Well, we've done a little checking into that since then. First of all, there is no Minnesota course. So we don't know what the course would be, and Department of Public Safety would have to approve any such course consistent with its already existing and pretty strict guidelines. So there is no Minnesota course to take. We suspect that what happened without knowing was someone got a password for another sort of test or demo course. It might not have been a course from that was actually in existence in any other state. It was probably the demo course, some of which other driver's license or driver teachers have access to. So members, before I turn it over, I know the time is short and the hour is late. I just want to say that all this is doing is providing an option, an item on the menu for people. It's not a mandate. It's an item on the menu. And I think this wave in education in general is probably coming, although that's for you to decide, not me. I'm not on this committee, and you're the expert, not me. But it's only an option. It's not a mandate. And it's a reasonable one, considering, in my judgment, what the rest of the United States has. And I want you to consider, too, if you would, the fact that we are willing to be accommodating here and scale this back to allay any concerns that people might have. So with that, I'd like, if I could, Mr. Chair, to hand it over just to our sole other testifier to introduce yourself to the record.
Thank you, Representative Simon, and welcome to the committee on a hopefully, no doubt, a warm, nice, pleasant early spring evening in Minnesota. Good to see you again. If you can state your name for the record and give us your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman Mariani and committee. My name is Debbie Prudholm, and I am the owner of the second largest driving school in Minnesota. And I really appreciate you taking the time to hear about this option for teenagers. I just want to share with you a little bit about myself, because I want you to know that I am dealing at the highest levels of the planning for driver education. I'm involved in a federal project right now. It's been a year-long project with NHTSA, working as one of 15 experts from across the U.S., and happen to be the only woman on the panel, too, to help set the standards and examine driver education. I founded an association in 1997, right after we bought our driving school, that was focused on professional instruction. I saw a need right away, and I just couldn't sit idly by. I also have worked on one textbook that is nationally used, and I'm currently a reviewing author on one of the national textbooks that is in a current revision. I've won several awards from the National Association, and I serve at the highest level of the National Driving School Association. So, those are all of my esteemed credentials. But the most important qualification I have here today is that I have actually trained tens of thousands of drivers over the last 12 years. And I think that puts me in a very unique position. And, when I first started learning about online education back 4 years ago, I actually was very, very adamantly opposed to it. Almost, you might say, a little bit in a fanatical way. But then I really started to look at what it has to offer and my defenses began to drop, and I realized where my real fear was coming from. I was able to address that head on and find that I didn't need to be afraid like that, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. You know, you're going to find out from the testimonies that the driving school is actually divided on this issue. There are owners that are for online education as an option for teens, and there are some opponents. And I've just dedicated the last 12 years of my life, literally, to helping teens learn how to drive. And I personally would not make a recommendation that would put vulnerable people in more of a harm's way. So I just want you to know that I come to you with a very earnest and heartfelt recommendation to allow this as an option. I just want to mention, Representative Simon did such a great job at kind of covering the issues, and I don't want to belabor the point. But, you know, the security and fraud issues that are raised, those have really been addressed in various ways. And I don't want to go over those ways because many of you might be aware of that. But those are really no longer real, you know, real legitimate issues. And in terms of the quality of instruction, the Department of Public Safety is going to approve all of the program that's offered in Minnesota. We can be very proud of their approval process. We have excellent curriculum content standards currently that we abide by as driving school owners, and any delivery method would have to abide by the standards that are set by DPS. And as Representative Simon mentioned, you've got that backstop of the instruction permit test, that knowledge test. And you may hear other people criticize that test, but I really don't think that it's that we should expect the educational system to compensate for an inadequate test. If that was determined to be inadequate, I personally don't think it's inadequate. I think that we have an excellent test. I traveled 18 states this past summer. I know a driving school owner in every state in the United States, and I've seen our test compared to other tests, and we in Minnesota can be proud of the test that we have. And that backstop is a very important point to consider. And also in these handouts, you can see some of the features and benefits. And I just want to point out one of these that is on this sheet, and that's about the accessibility of driver education. You know, currently in the state, by estimation, it seems about 69% to 70% of the teens are actually accessing driver education. That's 30% of people who are not accessing driver education. Primarily, it could be a financial reason. Maybe the parents can't drive them the 10 times, the 45 miles each way. Perhaps it's not affordable. It's too much of a burden to the family. And I cannot think of any reason why we would withhold additional access to driver education classrooms for teenagers. It's got such a potential to bring consistency and driver education to people who may not have had access to that in the past. And also, just a quick point about the Department of Public Safety report. In testimony to follow, you may hear that about some of the comments here that could be taken out of context. One in particular I'd like to mention is any talk about the Texas study. I know the person who did the Texas study, Val Pezzel from Texas A&M, and I was talking to him the other day. He said that, you know, that we shouldn't represent that parent-taught driver education is anything is not comparable to online education. So you have to keep that in mind as this report is referenced. You know, and another thing I'd like to mention is I really do believe that teenagers are honest. I have 35 students up in Rush City right now that are in a classroom with me. We finish up on Friday. And, you know, they are wonderful, and I love them. And they know what's good for them, and they're not out to scam the system. And they do want to learn. And I am not going to be able to say in any way, shape, or form that teenagers are dishonest or that they will take the path of least resistance. I want to have more confidence in the children that we're raising. You know, and just a side benefit of online education is that the parent is actually in the learning environment of the home. So the parent has potentially more opportunity to participate in that learning process. You know, I do believe in this. I believe in this because this offers accessibility. It offers some improved consistency possibilities. and it is more affordable. And I would love to see a day where all of our wonderful Minnesota-specific resources, like Room to Live, the Minnesota Trucking Association video, the Gift of Life videos, I would like to see a day when all of those Minnesota-specific resources are available to our teens and not on the floor of a program manager or a driving school owner. Because sometimes that's what happens out of practical need. And, you know, I just want to address this, the reason that I was initially against this concept and kind of what changed my mind is I had to really ask myself why. Why are you against this? And it was fear. It was fear of a changing business model. And I really don't think that that is a good enough reason to withhold an option for teens that could really provide some additional benefits. And I do appreciate other people's concerns. I honestly do. And I also understand their fears of changing business models. But I would just like to challenge all of us to move forward and not put our backs against the door and embrace something. Help us mold it and bring this online for the kids of Minnesota. And I would ask you to please support this option as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Prudhomme. I appreciate your patience and willingness to wait around to offer testimony. Representative Simon, we have a couple of members who have questions, and then we have, I think, three individuals who have offered, who wish to testify on the bill. And what I'd like to do is to limit our con, if you will, testifiers to 15 minutes. It is late. I want to make sure we keep us moving. And so that's, you know, trying to get some parity here with time. So members, if your questions could be short and concise to the point, I'd greatly appreciate it. We have Representative Swales, Representative Nornes, and I believe Representative Newton. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon, I just have a question. Does the Department of Public Safety, are they here this evening, and could they explain how this would be administered?
Representative Simon.
Hi, Mr. Chair. I don't know if anyone's here. Okay, great. And maybe they could explain that. Their position on the bill is neutral, that I know.
And members, I would like to keep the DPS's testimony brief. I trust that DPS issues have been thoroughly vetted in the Transportation Committee. Good evening. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and we can repeat the question if you haven't heard it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Deb Carlson. I am the exam program manager with DVS, and one of my work units oversees the driver education program here in Minnesota. This is the first time I've had a good look at this amendment language, so at this point, unless there's questions to answer, basically our position is neutral on this. I believe that the legislative report spells out what we found in doing the research on what occurs in online education, that theory delivery across the country at this point. And if there's questions for the committee, I'd be willing to try to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. Representative Swales?
Well, I'm fine. I'm a little frustrated that Representative Simons was sharing the example of what's going on with online training for instructors, because the man who is subbing for me while I'm gone for the spring semester is an English teacher, but he's also the driver's ed instructor who did get his online from St. Cloud. And there was a lot of trips to St. Cloud that was included in that. There was online discussions where, you know, 25 people were online at the same time with a professor at St. Cloud. So we're not comparing apples to apples here. It is apples to oranges. And I think we need to not generalize and say that. And I also want you to know that I have been deluged with emails this week about this bill. And that no emails told me to support the bill. Two an email said, please maintain that one-on-one interaction between teacher and student. One woman today emailed me. I had her son this fall, and she said, my son is so easily distracted. It would, you know, if he didn't have the benefit of in-class discussion and that teacher who could talk about relevant weather conditions and road problems in our community, this boy would not have done as well. And so I'm just wanting to emphasize that I just want to maintain mm-hmm. some control over what young people hear and are exposed to in terms of personal responsibility when they're driving a vehicle that weighs a ton. And I think that's just important for us to be thinking about.
Representative Dornan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, I guess, real brief. I talked to the owner of a driving school in my community, too, and he told me that the courses would be taught out of California. Is that correct? I guess, how many providers of this online training are there in the country?
Representative Simon.
As far as I know, there are a number of them. The one that I've been working with primarily is one out of California. But remember, the Department of Public Safety would have to do all of this. And they do curricula for all of the states that they're in. I don't even know if they're in all of these states that provide it, but this one company that I know of, all of California, is. I don't know where the other companies are out of, whether they're out of California or some other state.
Right. And Mr. Chair, just one quick comment. Looking at the map that you provided, I guess the concern I would have is that there are a lot of commercial programs, particularly in some of the smaller communities, but also some larger ones, too. So the impact on those small businesses, I guess, would be a concern of mine. I guess that's basically all I have to say on the matter. So.
Very well. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's unfortunate that Representative Benson is not here, because he's been pretty vocal, having been an instructor for quite a number of years. And I remember one comment that he made that really stuck with me is that someone can memorize that driver's manual in 30 minutes. You know, so it's not all that complicated a thing, and it doesn't take 30 hours to train someone. But I think, you know, there's a larger issue here, and we're having more and more classes that are mandatory in high school, and less electives. You know, kids want to get into band. They've also got 4 hours of math, 4 hours of English, 3 hours of science in many schools. We just did an hour of physical education. You got social studies. There are less and less electives, and kids that want to go through and say they want to take music or band, they're finding that they don't have enough electives. And this driver's ed is an elective. This gives them an option. And also, we have a lot of dropouts. And there are a lot of kids, especially in our communities of color, that don't finish school and don't get to the point of taking driver's ed. And I think this provides a venue for them to be able to complete the driver's ed course and be able to drive. So I just wanted to make those comments.
Thank you for your observations, Representative Newton, Representative Cash, and then Representative Depke.
Thank you. And this is for the testifier. When you're taking a look at current Minnesota statute in dealing with how we manage online learning as it is right now, part of our statute does expect that there is actual teacher contact time or other student-to-teacher communication. And I guess for myself, if you could please comment on what is that student-to-teacher communication, what is that venue that they would have then to be able to make this work, as well as then how is the Minnesota Department of Education taking a look at this, because they would then have to okay or approve all online learning providers.
Representative Simon.
Oh, for me? Or okay.
Doesn't matter for you or the testifier.
Or Ms. Prudel. Or Ms. Well, Carlson.
I would just say this. You know, traditionally, as I understand it legally, it's always been the Department of Public Safety that does the review and not the Department of Education when it comes to driver's education. The other thing I would say about the online component in generally, in terms of that mix of actual person-to-person time and then online time, Representative Twales is right. There is that the online portion isn't just solely online, but I would argue that learning to drive isn't either, even with this. You've still got the 6 hours of behind the wheel, and then you've got 30 hours of classroom time that could either be with a classroom teacher or online. And but to your question, Representative Cass, it's never been, to my knowledge, ever, the Department of Education who reviews this. It's always been the Department of Public Safety.
Ms. Prudel?
I was just going to share an experience I had in the summertime. I was at a conference with somebody.
Well, I need you to be brief.
Yes, that was doing an online course that was would fall underneath those guidelines of the teacher being available, and they were actually doing it on their BlackBerry. And I leaned over and I said, you know, what you must get a lot of email. And he said, well, I'm doing my driver's ed course right now. And I was floored. I was like, wow, that's so interesting that that qualifies as student-teacher contact. I just wanted to share that story.
Thank you. We'll take two more questions, and then we're going to hear from testifiers in the public who are opposed to the bill. Representative Dapke, and then Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know the Department of Drivers Vehicle, what department? I'm sorry, I'm getting tired.
Oh, well, I'm tired, Representative.
Just testified, but I am reading from their executive summary, and I maybe was one of the few people in the world that read their executive summary. And I know Representative Simon did state that many states have already have the online, but it did say that only two of the 12 states have formally evaluated the internet-based instruction. The value of those studies is somewhat limited, it did not examine the scores or pass rates of students on driver licensing road tests, was one of the big things that they missed. And it did not compare students' subsequent violation and crashes. The Texas study focused on the broader topic of the effectiveness of parent-taught driver education. It goes on to say, and I won't take up our time on saying it, but it says that some of the contributing factors in teen crashes include immaturity, lack of driving experience, a higher propensity for risk-taking behaviors, inexperience and recognizing hazards and illusion of vulnerability and so forth. As a parent, I can testify. My two teenagers had all of those, and we had issues. They had a car available for them when they were 16, and believe me, if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't let that happen for a lot of different reasons, and we're still dealing with it. I just think that 30 hours of instruction is there for a reason that we have in this state, and to take all of it on an online class and to not have that human contact, that behind the wheel of someone who teaches them and is able to monitor their maturity and their propensity for risk-taking is dangerous, not only for the student, and even if it is a student driver, I wouldn't want to be driving with a student driver that has my life in their hands, that hasn't had that contact, that human contact with an adult that teaches them those instincts and those things that they need to stay alive.
Simon, I just want to make sure we're clear. We're not talking about the behind-the-wheel component of this. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. Would you care to further comment?
Well, I just want to emphasize, and, you know, mm-hmm. I think I sense that, you know, people have good faith on both sides and made up their minds. I just want to emphasize that this is only an option. It's only a menu item. And the arguments that we're hearing are great arguments for why you would forbid your kids from doing it online. They're excellent arguments for that. I'm not so sure they're excellent arguments for saying this can never be an option, given that a third of the United States is already doing it. Apparently, they're satisfied with it. And so this is just an opportunity for Minnesota to do it. I understand that there are problems that some people have with it, and that's why we have voluntarily, after talking with a lot of people, decided to draw way, way back and say we'll only do it in two counties, only for a limited period of time, and then follow it up with a self-funded study about precisely the things that Representative Dapke was talking about in terms of looking at the scores and the crash rates and all the rest. So, you know, it's one of those things. I sense that folks, have strong feelings on both sides, but this is just offering an option. That's all it is, an option that a third of the United States already has.
Representative Simon, it's not a bad idea to struggle with new ideas. Ms. Carlson, I'm told that perhaps I did not allow you to respond to the previous question. I want to make sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to. The question that was posed about the delivery methods that currently do exist with the curriculum that we allow, basically you have the instructor in the classroom. It can be done also teleconferencing. And, of course, there's the homeschool option, too, for homeschool students. So there are different methods of delivery that are already approved. When we amended the rule back in 2003, the driver education rule, which is 7411, the online was written in there, and it currently exists for adults only. So we did take a look at it at that time.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. I'm going to take one more question at this point from Representative Dietrich. I know Representative Peterson has a question, but I do want to bring the other testifiers down, and allow them their time to testify. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Part of my question has been answered, and but I am still a little miffed by this. I guess I've learned something here tonight. I did not realize it was the Commissioner of Public Safety that has control or jurisdiction over the driver's education classroom delivered in a classroom in our public schools. I'm a little surprised about that. And but I think that the reason that the average public doesn't know that happens, chain of command is like that, is because there is a teacher there monitoring that curriculum and probably adapting the curriculum and making sure that the teacher is presenting the curriculum in a way that students relate to, that they interact with, and to have the highest, make sure that they holding all kids accountable and that they are achieving to the highest levels possible. That being said, I would wonder then, going through this type of a policy, why the Commissioner of Education does not have some jurisdiction over an online learning class that could be used, that could eventually be into the public school. And I think that probably most of us wouldn't have problems with this on a very small scale for a very certain limited population. But I think that we can see what happens with these things is that pretty soon then kids are taking it in masses. The chairman and I are both looking at online learning this year, and so why would we have two different standards, one for online learning in the K-12 system and then one standard for online learning for driver's education? And I think that that's where we're seeing that this could possibly go. So, Representative Simon, I would, whatever happens here tonight and what you do with this bill, I think that that at least I would like to see some merging of the syllabus, the objectives, the student performance, and putting some of that under the domain of the Department of Education.
And just a little clarifying thing for my sake, and then I'll turn to the for response here. But my understanding is that not all pre-behind the wheel instruction is being offered in a K-12 setting. Am I?
Right.
Ms. Prudhomme, I think that goes to the work that you do as a private provider. So we do have, and I get you, Representative Dietrich, we have a very diverse platform from which those elements are taught.
Mr. Chair, if I could comment on that. Yes, I realize that. I, being the overachieving parent that I thought I was going to be until my son trained me, I thought I was going to send him to that school so that he could be taking more higher level electives in school. Well, the higher level electives never happened, but he did take the driving force pay, and then my second child, I changed course, and I do have to, I'm sorry, but I do have to say that the school experience was far superior, so that's my personal experience with it.
Ms. Carlson, did you want to respond?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Basically, to answer your question, in, I believe it was 1998, approximately around that time, is when the statute was changed and the Department of Public Safety took over the oversight of all driver education programs in Minnesota. So that would be the public schools, the private schools, and the commercial industry. And now, as far as that goes, we just approve public programs. In other words, we just take a look at their approval and meet the criteria that are set. We have no oversight over the teachers and the instructors because they are public school teachers. And we've tried to raise the bar on the commercial instructor side to be equal to the criteria, well, not equal to, because they don't need to have a teaching degree to be a commercial driving instructor, but as far as background checks and that type of testing, that we evaluate of the instructors. So we've tried to merge the programs, and that's the history on it.
Very well. Members, I want to hear, it's good to have music at the end of the day. I'm going to ask several members who have asked to testify against the bill to come forward. Mr. Thiessen, I believe you've been waiting for quite a while, sir, and it's I extend my apologies to you for not having gotten this hearing off to the time that we had hoped to get to. We also have Charles Hasten and then Jan Oswager. And what I would ask is if you can all come forward together. Members, I would like to keep this part of the testimony to 15 minutes, and so I would ask the three or four for potentially other testifiers to bear that in mind in terms of making sure that your other citizens have time to offer testimony. It is late, and this committee will meet again tomorrow morning at bright and early at 8:30 a.m. Sorry, Representative Downey. We're coming back. Mr. Thiessen, welcome to the committee. It's a pleasure to have you here. We have a representative by your last name, so I hope we're pronouncing your name correctly. And I believe you're going to start us off. If you can perhaps state, or if you can state your name for the record and then give us your testimony.
I will.
Thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman.
Good evening.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Frank Thiessen, and I am the past president and a board member of the Minnesota Driver Traffic Safety Education Association. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to address you. We do not believe that online driver education should be accepted as a state-approved path to getting a driver's permit at this time. We agree with the Department of Public Safety's conclusion regarding online driver ed, and I quote, "Internet-based classroom driver education is relatively new, and the efficacy of this form of instruction is still largely undetermined." End of quotation on that. That is just not good enough for Minnesota's young drivers to be. Our organization also realizes that the online learning expanding rapidly, it may eventually be online driver education that will prove to be efficacious and approved by the state. However, we believe that oversight of any teaching learning concept used to educate our young people, including online learning, should be overseen by our state's teaching learning agency, the Department of Education. This bill should be defeated, and I thank you again for the chance to speak to you. I know time is pressed, and that's what I have to share with the organization.
Thank you, Mr. Thiessen. I appreciate your testimony and your patience with the committee and accommodating our schedule as well. I believe Mr. Hasten, is that correct? Charles Hasten?
You can
identify yourself, yourself for the record, and give us your testimony.
Chairman, members. My name is Chip Hyson. I am the owner of Safeway Driving School, which is the state's largest commercial driver education school, teaching about 4,000 students out of 18 metro area locations. Safeway agrees that self-directed internet-based courses can be effective in delivering certain types of content. Busy schedules, different learning styles make the internet an attractive option. We're on board with that. We get it. I've got teenage daughters. Safeway, therefore, is in favor of moving the testable content of driver's education, things like signs, lines, and regulations, to the internet so that parents and students have a flexible and convenient option. And importantly, there's a way to test for effectiveness. However, Safeway is concerned that lessons related to attitude, responsibility, courtesy, judgment, risky behavior, road rage, and things like that can't be effectively delivered on the internet, where the course is competing with Facebook, emails, text messages, IMs, and who knows what else for the student's attention. Remember, as you just heard on page 3 of the report, teens have tragic crashes because they are immature, because they have a high propensity for risk-taking behavior, they have an illusion of invulnerability, they don't recognize hazards, to name a few reasons. Knowing this, Minnesota and many other states have long required 30 hours of classroom instruction, even though the 40-question knowledge test required to get a driver's permit can be learned in 30 minutes or 5 hours, whatever it is. It's a lot less. And why do they do that? Because the state realizes that additional classroom time allows teachers to focus on attitude, behavior, judgment. Those are the things that turn a knowledgeable driver into a safe driver. Safeway believes that it's the right attitude that gets kids home safely every night. It's an attitude that says no when too many kids pile in the car. It's an attitude that takes keys away from a friend rather than allow them to drive home after drinking. An attitude to ignore the text message time while they're driving. We believe the internet can't teach the right attitude, and as a recently completed DPS report makes clear, no study has proven that it can. Besides pointing out the lack of proof that internet drivers' ed even works, the Department of Public Safety report says that there are problems ensuring the identity of the person taking the course, that the students devote the full 30 hours to taking the course, and that the students don't distract themselves while they're doing so. And based on my experience, I think their concerns are well-founded. I am currently enrolled in the California Online Driver's Ed program for driversed.com. That's the program that satisfies California's 30-hour requirement. Before the Senate hearing on the companion bill to 575 a couple of weeks ago, I had completed 29% of the course in about 2.5 hours. At that pace, I would finish the course in 10 hours. That's one-third of the requirement in the state of Minnesota and in the state of California. During that same Senate hearing, while the proponents were testifying about the security of their program, one of the senators, it was pointed out correctly, used my user ID and password and completed some of the lessons for me. And while they were testifying about their proprietary software that would pay students so that they don't race ahead, the senator went through 87 slides in 4 minutes. Now, why would teens go through 87 slides in 4 minutes? But that teenage daughters, and I can tell you why. Because they could. Because they know the only thing between them and the road is the knowledge test. 40 multiple choice or true false questions. Before each of the driversed.com lessons, there's a 10-question quiz, then the answers, the same quiz that's given at the end of the lesson. If all a student needs to advance are the answers to 10 questions, why would they read through 87 slides and sit through a video? Wouldn't they just be tempted to race through the slides and quickly retake the test while the answers are still fresh in their mind? That's all that's being tested. Isn't that all they have to know? Well, I think so, because teens might rush through these lessons for the very same reasons that they're involved in crashes. They're immature. They lack experience. They have a tendency for risky behavior. They have an illusion of invulnerability. They have poor judgment. That's why some teens have crashes, and that's why some teens will do the minimum necessary to get their license. We simply don't believe that an internet course should be allowed to enable and reward that tendency. However, as I said earlier, Safeway does support self-directed internet-based instructions, but only for the testable content, such as signs, road markings, regulations. Our recommendation is to begin with 6 hours of internet learning coupled with 24 hours of teacher-led classroom instruction. That way, Minnesota introduces the convenience of online learning but retains the benefits of teacher-led classrooms. We suggested this to the proponents of the bill, that it be amended to allow a portion of the 30-hour requirement to be satisfied by an internet course while retaining the other portion for teacher-led classrooms. Again, the best of both worlds. However, given the choice you have here today of either completely replacing classroom instructions with a computer or not, we believe it's better to oppose this bill and to propose another version in the future that makes more sense for Minnesota. As for the amendment takes a different approach than I would have approached. As you know, my view is that the hand ought to be on the dial that turns the content, not the dial that turns how many kids get it. I don't think that an internet course that's not appropriate for 100% of Minnesota teens should be appropriate for 15%. I do believe, though, that if you're going to introduce online, it shouldn't be the 15% of the population. It should be for 15% of the content. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you've got.
Thank you, Mr. Heisman, for your very concise and clear testimony. We'll hear from Jan Alslager, and then we'll see if committee members have questions for these testifiers. Ms. Alslager.
Mr. Chairman, I'm the committee, Jan Alslager, Education Minnesota. And when this issue first came up last year, our driver's ed teachers were extremely concerned. I was really surprised at the level of activity that they showed on this issue. And their number one concern is public safety and quality of instruction. And I will just put it right out here.
Are they concerned about their jobs a little bit? Sure. But they never said that to me about why they wanted to fight this bill. They are concerned about public safety. You've heard tonight that this is an option. But it isn't an option for the person driving down the road that approaches a student who has taken this course. So when you think about the option, know that it is affecting other people. We've been told that they have to pass the test. Yes, and as the previous testifier talked about how it can be easy to go through the slides. When a student is taking the test, they know, and they pass it, they know that red means red and they have to stop and green means go. But when they're in accidents, and on page 3 of the Department of Public Safety document, which Representative Depke pointed out, is which I think is one of the biggest arguments for why this bill should be defeated, is that they're not thinking about the right answers that they got, because generally all of these kids do know the rules of the road. They know who has the right-of-way. They know red means stop. They know those things. What they don't know is the issues that Representative Depke pointed out. The judgment doesn't always fit with the rules of the road. In other words, when there's an accident that a teen is involved in, generally, it's not because they didn't pass the test or they didn't know the answers. Because of the feeling of being invincible, the lack of driving experience, the immaturity, and so on. In terms of security, yes, there might be a number of security questions, but all I have to do is my son could ask his neighbor friend to come over and sit down at the computer while he did something else, and when a security question pops up, he can say, what is your middle name? So that can be, and as the previous testifier testified, those aren't necessarily all secure. Representative Foyle talked about higher ed online, and I think you brought up some great points. Higher ed is required to have faculty involved. K-12 does require interaction with a licensed Minnesota teacher. This does not. You can watch a classroom discussion of driver's ed. You cannot, as an individual student, be involved in a classroom discussion. Teachers work very hard to have teachable moments. I think we can all think back, for the most part, of our own driver's ed classes when someone would come in and say, my mom did this when she was driving. And all of the kids got very excited and involved. I think it's one of the most interactive courses that a lot of students take. This isn't a video game. Driving is serious. A car could be a dangerous weapon, and we know that our teenagers are not intending to use it as a dangerous weapon. But when you put a lack of judgment together with a vehicle, it could be the outcome. I would just go back to the issue of the amendments which creates a pilot. Public safety is number one. A decision you make here today could have the impact of letting a parent decide if their child could take this course. But how does it affect the other people on the highway? And thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Halswager. I want to thank the testifiers for respecting the committee's time. You did wonderful in terms of the tight time constraints I placed upon you. Please stay put because we may have some questions. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question, I think, was probably for Representative Simon.
Why don't we wait for that and see if there's anyone else in the committee, Representative Peterson.
He'd have to know. I just wanted to know if the parent had to sign off on these online courses or if the student could make that decision on their own.
I'm sorry, Representative Peterson, was that question directed to our current testifiers?
When I registered for driversed.com California course, all they needed was a credit card number. There was no sign off by a parent that I remember.
Thank you. Representative McFarland, I believe you have someone who offered to testify. We tried to kind of keep the testimony tight, but obviously citizens have made the effort to be here, and I would certainly be willing to entertain a very concise message.
I don't know the gentleman, but I do know he did testify at the transportation hearing.
And I believe this is Mr. David Baranek. Mr. Baranek, good evening. I do apologize for, I'm sure it seems like a very rushed effort on the part of the chair. We're just dealing with very tight logistics and a very long day here. So please, state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Okay. My name is David Benjamin Baranek, and I appreciate you letting me come on up here to speak, Mr. Chair and Representative. I just have a couple things I'd like to say to all of you. First off, I've been teaching since I was 21, and I'm 31 now. I own a driving school called Classic Driving School, DBA Training Wheels Driver's Ed. I've taught thousands of students how to stay alive out there. I'd just like to say a couple things, if I could. This was written by a concerned citizen in the state of Minnesota. I'm driving on freeway going about 60 miles per hour, and I look around in rush hour traffic to see that I'm surrounded by stressed out people. Everyone seems to be on a cell phone, eating breakfast, doing the things that they were supposed to do before they left the house. And then a light bulb went off in my head when I realized this. These are grown adults I'm sharing the road with. These are people that got their license 20, 30, 40 years ago. No wonder why everyone seems a little out of touch with the roadways. We're supposed to be grown, mature adults, the ones that are supposed to model the behavior that we want to instill in our own children. We sit here and complain about teens behind the wheel, but what about us? I think we all need to take a refresher course in driver's ed. Let us take back our children and learn to have a dialogue with them over an extremely important issue such as this. Having an option to take driver's ed online not only will teach our loved ones how to drive, but it will also give us parents the opportunity to get more involved with our kids' lives and also relearn the rules of the road again, the same rules that we've been breaking every day since 1960. Doesn't it seem as though something is pulling our families apart? Wrote a mission statement for all of you because I was a little bit disappointed how the Senate went, but our mission is to save lives and to eliminate teen crashes. In doing so, we must do everything possible in our power to give the highest support to the parents of new teen drivers as well as students. We need to allow the classroom education to be administered through online classrooms if parents and students choose to do so, based on their family's individual lifestyle or circumstances. The choice should be up to the family on what best suits their needs. It should not be up to the state of Minnesota to take God-given rights away from a family. It is an absolute privilege to receive a license to drive a motorized vehicle. However, it is not the state's right to restrict the ability to receive the education to only online classroom settings. An online driver education curriculum is absolutely necessary to have as a choice for families to make. More importantly, the state of Minnesota Department of Education needs to enforce the curriculum approved by online means to the highest regard, which I do believe is that's why we're here.
Mr. Baranek, I'm going to ask you to wrap it up, if you would.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
With all due respect, sir, I believe that the teens of Minnesota's lives are going to be affected. Approved online classrooms will meet the curriculum standards as well as security measures to administer the highest cutting-edge quality in regards to delivery of online driver education. It is important to note that the state of Minnesota Department of Education and the Department of Public Safety will only approve online driver education programs that meet or exceed the highest standards in curriculum and security measures. The state of Minnesota already requires the teen to practice 30 hours with their parents or legal guardian who holds a valid license. And please make note that I fully support the statute as a minimum standard only. As it stands now, Minnesota State requires new teen drivers to pass a state administered permit test with 80%, and this test is taken after the student has had 30 hours of classroom training. If the students do not pass this test and also enroll in 6 hours of behind-the-wheel classroom training with a state-approved provider, they do not receive their permits anyway. So it is in the student's best interest to receive this information. I'd also like to state the fact that the majority of practice time is by far done with the parents right now as it stands. In my 10 years of traffic safety instruction administered to teens and the parents of teens,
I believe, and would testify as fact that parents have the most influence in the way their team compiles an attitude toward traffic safety.
Mr. Baranek, I appreciate your passion. I really do, and I'm listening carefully.
Mm-hmm.
We have six other citizens who are gathered here to offer testimony on two other bills, and we've kept them
mm-hmm.
waiting a long time. I suspect we're going to keep them waiting for another hour and a half, even after you're done.
Yes.
And so if you could please wrap up, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Sir, I respect you. We have a couple hours to dictate the future lives of our teens in Minnesota.
Mr. Baranek, this bill has a long-awaited journey through at least two other committees,
yeah.
if it survives this committee, in order for us to fully vet. So I would, with all due respect, please ask you to,
okay.
to wrap up your testimony. I do appreciate your presence here.
Thank you, sir. It is the traffic safety school that needs to reinforce and perfect safe defensive driving skills to save injuries and lives. With my past experience in saving lives in regards to traffic safety to thousands of students and parents within the state of Minnesota, I do believe that it is in the best interest to the new team drivers that this law be passed. And the bottom line is that by passing this law, lives will be saved. It will bring parents and hold parents more responsible. They are the ones that are going to be practicing 30 hours with their kids. They need to be educated, and that's where they are going to be educated by, with online means. It does not matter how long I teach a student. It does not matter. What matters is are the parents educated, because they will drive just like them without any reinforcement or whatever you want to say. So if the parents are educated, I promise you that these teens are going to be better educated. The behind-the-wheel phase, the behind-the-wheel lessons, that's for reinforcing that traffic safety matters. But if the parents don't care, then it does not matter what we teach in class.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Baranek. Representative Simon, I think we're back to you. Are there any other questions or observations from committee members?
Chair, did you say there were other testifiers?
I don't believe here? There are.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. Okay. If I said that, I misspoke.
Well, members, you have other bills to get to, and I understand there's okay. Good faith, people on both sides of good faith on this bill. I would just say this.
Representative Simon, I do believe there is a question for Representative Lord. I want to make sure you're able to do your wrap-up
sure.
at the appropriate time. I apologize for interrupting. Representative Lou.
I thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully a fairly quick question. Just, is there any differential in cost for those states that have gone to online? Is it less expensive for families to do the driver's ed portion online versus the classroom time, or is it the same?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my understanding is it's the same. I mean, they try to be price competitive, so, yeah, it's the same. I don't think there's any appreciable difference. So, members, I know it's late, and you have other... I don't think there's any appreciable difference. So, members, I know it's late, and you have other bills to get to. You know, the whole idea behind this bill, which, as I said, has always... had in all its other committee hearings wide bipartisan support, is that this is only an option. And I understand there are people here who have concerns about safety, they have concerns about security. But as amended, I think we've come a very long way here, unilaterally, to make it only a pilot project. Keep in mind that the bipartisan support was when it was statewide, without this amendment. Now coming to this committee, we've decided to narrow it to only two counties, to make a self-funded study so we do have the answers to some of the questions here. And I appreciate some of the comments about some of the driving instructors as well. They're well represented here. I suspect that a lot of the emails and letters you're getting, though no less heartfelt, are organized. Let's face it. I mean, there are lobbyists in this room who are ginning this up, and this doesn't mean they're less heartfelt. It just means it's not organic exactly. And I would say this, I want to be sensitive to the idea that, you know, we need to be teaching judgment or we need to be teaching good rules of the road, but the test in Minnesota simply doesn't require that right now. And if that's the will of this committee or of the legislature to make sure that judgment and not having a false sense of security and not thinking one is invincible ought to be a prerequisite to be on the road, and maybe it should be, then that ought to be part of the test. But it isn't. Right now, and we're only talking about the permit test, it's a 40-question multiple-choice test. And I don't want to minimize it, but I do want to say if we want to rethink things and that there ought to be more than just the 40 questions, then maybe that's a whole different bill entirely. But right now it's 40 questions. And it seems to me and to everyone, all the other committees who have heard this bill, that it's a reasonable thing to propose that we have this as an option. So I leave it in your hands, members, and
With that, I would just urge you to think about doing things differently and providing an option for the kids and families in Minnesota. Not a mandate, but an option. So thank you for your time, no matter how it comes out.
Thank you, Representative Simon. And you probably by now have discovered that, and I'm sure not just by virtue of the chairman being a Latino, but this is a very passionate committee. It's not a value only shared in the Latino community. Members, with that, the chair renews his motion that House File 575, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee with a further recommendation that it be re-referred to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Members, I'm going to ask for a show of hands. The chair is in doubt. All in favor, please raise your hands. All opposed, same sign. On a vote of 5-10, the motion does not prevail.
Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Members, the next bill up there is... What's my number? House File 1186, that's my bill. I'm going to ask Representative Cass to lead us through this next portion of the committee hearing. And we are not going to vote on this bill, so my hope, quite frankly, is that we can hear from the testifiers, have a little bit of discussion. We'll be circling back to this issue within the next week for sure.
All right, thank you, Representative Mariani. You have moved your bill to House File 1186 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus K-12 ed policy bill. With that, I will leave it to you to explain your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that is my motion, and I would then move a DE. I want to make sure I have this right because I have so many papers here. Is it DE5? Okay.
Yes.
The DE5 amendment. And Mr. Chair, members, I'm making a habit out of this coming up here without the amendment, but wondering if our page representative Newton could bail me out.
All right, Representative Mariani moves the DE5 amendment, and as we customarily put it in the order that the author would like, if I could get all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. All right, the motion passed.
Mr. Chair, members, I will condense my testimony because in many ways this is really quite a simple concept, and I think the more important issues will come from testifiers and also from question and answers from the committee. As you know, over the course of this legislative session, and for those who have served this committee before, this committee has often accessed assistance on a pro bono basis from researchers both here in Minnesota and across the nation, but primarily here in Minnesota, primarily located within our MISU and University of Minnesota education policy centers, if you will. We sought that advice for the sake of helping to inform this committee's policy decisions based on research-based information. So we've in many ways have developed a culture of asking what research has to tell us in terms of emerging education policy here. As you know, the executive branch also has that capacity and has some wonderful individuals I've had the privilege to work with within the department that provide those services to the Department of Education, to the executive branch. And they also, members, access national experts, oftentimes through the form of grants, many of them federal grants. They recently engaged with ACHIEVE, for instance, to provide them ongoing advice about alternatives to the high stakes grant set. And that's good. I think having that kind of capacity in the executive branch makes the executive branch of the Department of Education a more rigorous and better policy, better as an institution and as a culture. What this bill basically seeks to do is to build that capacity within the legislative branch. And to do that beyond our current capacity of research work, which is really members primarily limited to helping members craft legislation and understand existing statute and kind of work us through the intricacies of statute. Of course, now we have Representative Overmiller, who is vying, I think, with our research in-house researchers for a new quality standard here. But nonetheless, we have access this year alone, several individuals, many of you remember Dr. Yates and Dr. Sato's testimony here, Dr. Warren, Austin University of Minnesota, and Dr. Lake from the University or from MinSQ. We also heard from Dr. John Ratty from Harvard. But members, we do so primarily at the good graces and the availability of those resources. They don't exist to provide those functions for us, and we're often basically asking them to detract from their primary responsibilities in their respective institutions to do that. It's not lost on me that as we continue to evolve a more modern, high-quality, high-standard education framework, K-12 education framework in our state, that many of the policy issues only grow in complexity. And that's matched by the complexity, as many of you know as educators, that we see in our K-12 schools. Complexity of geography, distinctions in terms of income and race and languages and learning styles. All these things that we're learning are very important for us to develop comprehension around in order to develop ever more effective teaching practices. So this bill would attempt to create that capacity within the Office of Educational Accountability, which is currently lodged at the University of Minnesota. Quite frankly, members, I would prefer that we just develop independent entity almost from scratch, if you will, because then we can write the whole mission, particularly around providing legislature advice. But as you all know, we're not in an era where growing, quote-unquote, government by adding new entities is perhaps not possible and also perhaps not acceptable given our many of the issues that we face in our state. So the idea was to identify as independent a body, a non-political body as possible. I scanned around, and of course I've had interactions with the Office of Educational Accountability, and have decided to lodge this effort within that entity. That body, members, for those particularly those who are new, is a body that was created several years ago to provide oversight of the department's management of our statewide accountability and assessment system, including how the department interacts with NCLB requirements. However, that entity it's been several years that it's been defunded, so while we still have the entity on the books, we no longer provide, at least for several years, have not provided funds for them to carry out that mission. It is not my interest or objection, quite frankly, to even reinvigorate that particular mission, because, frankly, I think that kind of oversight function is better lodged here in the legislative branch. Relative to the executive branch, my real goal is to stimulate a stable, persistent, can always count on entity that has access to good education research that can respond to our needs year round. However, the language is creatively, if you will, written in a way so that it meets the mission within which the OEA exists. I've worked with staff and research advocates to try to make that fit as good as possible and still get the desired outcome of having a body that can provide us education policy, research-based information over and above an accountability and assessment system. So members, that's it. This will eventually generate a fiscal note. It will require some level of appropriation unless the university and the Office of Education Accountability is willing to offer their services pro bono, but I doubt that they're willing to do that. It's my desire to have that discussion relative to those needs in our K-12 Finance Committee and try to be as creative as we can relative to perhaps accessing federal funds to at least kickstart this effort. Members, as you know, the governor himself has requested increases in testing expenses over and above the base. And so, for me, this is really the equivalent of the legislature's request in terms of building capacity. This is really all about building our own capacity to be better at what we do. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I would ask my testifiers to come forward and speak. And I suspect they do not need to be heavily encouraged to be very brief and concise in their testimony today.
Thank you. As the testifiers come forward, if you'd please state your name for the record, and feel free to start your testimony. And if we have any questions, we will open it up for members.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Wallach. I'm superintendent of Matamid High Schools. I've spent my career in education in Minnesota. I'm very excited about this topic. I want to make basically four points that I think would lend some credence to this bill. In 2007, I presented a paper to our professional association that we ought to be more about both research-based practice and those practices that are evidence-based. With the movement in standards and continuous improvement practice, those all districts and school boards having more data to work with, we should be paying attention to those practices that are evidence-based in other public schools, things that have worked, basically, and not recreating the wheel each time a new leader or a new school board member comes on the board. So these are my four points I'd like to make, and then I'll turn it to the other people testifying this evening. We have evidence of what works in public education. We don't always follow it based on all kinds of political will. So my argument is that for all the superintendents, all the school board members out there, let's have a repository of evidence-based practice. The second one is we do a lot of starting and stopping in public schools. I've had positions from paraprofessional to teacher to principal, special ed coordinator, special ed director, superintendent. I've seen that in Minnesota. We start and stop depending on all kinds of reasons. Evidence-based practice would give us that foundation. The third thing is that I think one of my concerns is you can see the gray hair. I'm in the twilight of my professional experience in Minnesota. There are many, many people like me, and I'm concerned that the young leaders coming in, whether they're school board members or whether they're principals or superintendents, that they really need a place that they can rely on for solid evidence of what works in this position. We don't have the Bush leadership program that we had in the 80s and 90s. We're basically asking people to come into these positions and pretty much saying, good luck, do a great job for us. And then the last comment I'd like to make is that having a repository that both the legislature and the professional people in Minnesota would have that we could share would also help us in being more strategic about how we use our resources. I am very concerned that in this time of diminishing resources that more of us should be doing the same kinds of strategies to reduce expenses and not just whichever, again, what is politically expedient. So those are my points, and I will let my other colleagues here testify on behalf of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jerry Robichaud, 30-some years as a school administrator. I had the fortune to go on to higher education and currently a professor in educational leadership at Minnesota State University, Mankato. Much of what Mr. Wallach has said is I would like to just echo is that over my years of experience as a school administrator, we have been reactive to things that are happening with all due respect, and a lot of times public school policy is developed by what's in the current headlines in the newspaper. And as we take a look at what is the research base, what is the best practice that needs to be looked at as it relates to what is going to be an effective educational system in the state of Minnesota, pre-K through 12. We have an effective education in the state of Minnesota. How can we make it more effective? How can we develop and use resources to a more effective and efficient manner based on evidence that is out there, research that's out there that says whether it's in the state of Minnesota and in K-12 systems or whether it's across the United States, what does that research say about the public policy that dictates what's happening in public education? I duly respect Representative Mariani's amendment to the original bill that was set up. It's engaging conversation with policymakers, with K-12 individuals, with teachers, with school leaders across the state. What should our school system look like? What's the big picture for K-12 education in the next 5 years? What's it going to look like? What do we want our students in Minnesota to be able to accomplish, and how are we going to measure those that accomplishment? But what is the big picture 10 years from now? What do we really want to take a look at? This bill, as it's been presented, is a good start. It's engaging that conversation. It's starting to have that dialogue about what direction we want to go and how we're going to go there. More importantly, the dialogue is based on the strong evidence and best practices, evidence-based and research of what we should be looking at in K-12 education. The bill, as it's been presented, and speaking very much in favor of that, one of the things that we need to do is we need to expand beyond just accountability and reporting. We need to take a look at what does it mean for teacher quality? What is happening as far as teacher quality? Those individuals that are standing in front of the classroom, what quality, what skills are those teachers coming to the classroom with? And more importantly, those that are practicing teachers, what kind of new skills do they need, given the changing demographics, given the changing dynamics that are happening in the classroom? How do we deal with that? In addition to that, is how do we develop a more engaged family in the educational process of students? What does the research say about that? What is the evidence-based practices about engaging parents more actively in the education of their students? How do you deal with the changing demographics of the schools regarding how do you create a multicultural, inclusive environment that addresses the changing demographics that all schools across the state of Minnesota are facing, not just Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the suburbs. Districts like CPI Minnesota, which has over 40% of its kindergarten students, are students of color. So how do we deal with that? So it isn't just a matter of accountability, it's a matter of how do you develop best practices, evidence-based, that is going to give us a comprehensive picture of what our school systems in the state of Minnesota should look like. And also equally across the state, what's good in Thief River Falls is good in St. Louis Park, is good in Minneapolis. Good teaching is good teaching, and how do we measure that and make sure that all students across the state are experiencing it? And this bill is an excellent start in developing that kind of a dialogue and continuing the dialogue.
And good evening, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Ciccone with Parents United, and we're very careful of what bills we support, and we actively support this bill. We make no secret of the fact that we believe schools are under-resourced, but we also understand that there's an appetite out there for the public to understand that those dollars are being used to increase student achievement. So with that, what this bill has the potential of providing for you, policymakers, is research and evidence on emerging trends for education, like RTI. Through data analysis, the evaluation of programs as to the efficacy for increasing student achievement, like learning communities. It has the opportunity that helps you support what you're talking to your constituents about as far as why you're choosing to invest dollars in specific programs like TCOMP. This appetite is insatiable. People want to know what evidence there is. And there are several groups out there right now. I would direct you to the Consortium for Chicago Schools, the Alberta Center for Child, Family, and Community Research, and the University of California that's developing research tools for public policy. I think Minnesota can be a leader here. And I will give to your pages for your review at some point a white paper, if you will, that Parents United has put together basically on the history and why we feel this proposal is of value. Thank you.
questions from members? Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions, hopefully quick. What would be the kind of the oversight of the governance structure? How would the mission and the scope and the objectives of this group be set? Does that already exist? Would it be a new function for the legislature?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, yes, the mission does currently exist. What I've done basically is kind of a pragmatic out of necessity. If you look at the original bill, we actually established an independent center. I really thought that in the times that we're at, that's probably not a strong, sellable concept. And so I was looking around for another place in which to lodge this. The OEA does have a mission. We prescribe what they're supposed to do. One of the things that the bill does do is it does remove some of the oversight elements, oversight of the Department of Education relative to both accountability and assessment systems, but nonetheless still, as a first step, attempts to evolve from them research-based information that starts within the accountability and assessment system in regards to how that speaks to us in terms of broad education policy issues. The office itself, as I mentioned, is really technically defunct. There is an individual that is still attached to the office and continues to, obviously doesn't have the resources to carry out the statutory language, but has other responsibilities relative to university research work, and so the university continues to make that investment. But it's only one individual at this point. And to my knowledge, there is no commission or body or advisory group that exists. I'm not sure, but I don't think that there is, that exists in terms of helping to govern the little work that office currently does.
Good follow-up, Downey. Thank you. I'm thinking about the lead time for this and how long it would take to actually get something of value. And obviously, if we start and have to create kind of the empirical base on our own from scratch, that's a long time. Are there strategies that this unit could employ to simply aggregate and correlate existing data, other studies from other states? Are there ways for us to get some real value from this in the short term?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there are vehicles by which you can aggregate and data that's out there and research that's out there regarding best practices, evidence-based educational components regarding teacher quality, for example. So you wouldn't be starting from scratch necessarily, but this activity would be that you would take a look at that current research out there. There's a lot of agencies that are doing some research. It's just kind of all over the place right now. It's going to take a means to put that together and say, what does that mean? For example, Chicago has some very dynamic things happening. What does that mean for transferable to a school district in the state of Minnesota? So the data is out there, the research is out there. It's just a matter of bringing it back in, analyzing it, doing some analysis of it, and what does it mean for not only the schools, but also the public policy that's going to be written and driven and driving the public schools in the state of Minnesota.
And then lastly, in what ways is this, would this be redundant with what NDE is doing currently? And any kind of forethought to strategies to not have redundant, overlapping, and duplicate cost functions that we're paying for as state taxpayers? Thank you.
Chair, Representative Downey, the department itself is actually pretty stressed right now in terms of being able to do many of the responsible data analysis and policy shaping that that they want to do, and we'll often hear from the commissioner that love to be able to engage, and she's actually been very willing to do that with the legislature. But there have been resource limitations there as well. I think for me the primary issue though has less to do with the legislative branch. Being dependent on the executive branch, regardless of party configuration, and more about building our own proactive capacity here in this legislative body.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani, I want to applaud you for your pragmatism and approach. I was going to comment on that, and I know you went into that with Representative Downey. You're the lead all. I was looking at the two, and that's exactly what you did, and I think it makes sense at this point in time. The question I had, and you said, I think you alluded to it, there's only maybe one person in this independent office of educational accountability currently. Having said that, there is an office, even though it's only one person. Have you talked to that person? And it'd be interesting to get some feedback from him or her regarding the mission and what your goals are. I guess I need to ask, first of all, did you collaborate with them in terms of their thoughts on this? And it'd be interesting to hear those.
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, first of all, the idea really originated here. As we, first, again, we're looking at this capacity building issue. I made a pragmatic decision about, here's a place we can lodge it in. So I basically informed them after the fact. And frankly, I think the office wants to be very careful that they're not, and the university just that they're not, attempting to instigate and lead on this issue. And I think it's appropriate. I think it's appropriate for the legislature to be identifying its needs and then to find the pragmatic ways in which it can resource it. The individual has expressed an interest in working with us on this. It's not fully fleshed out. They've begun to identify possible costs of what it would take. At one time, sort of a full disclosure, at one time, the Office of Educational Accountability, I believe I'm correct when I say this, I think the last time we appropriated to it, we appropriated $800,000 in the biennium. Now, it was carrying out a much different mission at that point. And so their expectation, at least preliminarily, in looking at what we're conceptualizing, is nowhere near that, but we're in the process of trying to sort that out with them.
Thank you.
Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment more than a question, and it really relates to both of the issues raised by Representative Demmer and Representative Downey. The work we've engaged in the last 18 months addressing the issues of multiple measures and reporting to parents and the public on accountability was initially intended to be funded out of the Office of Educational Accountability. That didn't happen, the funding piece. So we went ahead without the funding and partnered with the University of Minnesota, including the person who last was involved with the Office of Educational Accountability. But my point isn't so much about that entity as it is about the capacity of the university, both the University of Minnesota, the Minsker system, to be of help to us in these sorts of issues. And what we did is go to them and partner with them and ask for their expertise. And it wasn't a matter, Representative Downey, of doing a whole new research effort. It was taking advantage of existing knowledge and researchers who already had a lot to say about what the answer to that question would be. So that's how we pulled together our working teams, was to get people who had expertise in those areas. And I think it's exactly what we need for good policy, is to use people who are already committed to a life of research, policy are oriented toward a policy mind instead of influenced by the contingencies of a political session or legislative agenda. I'm not saying they aren't related, but what I would say is we couldn't replace what we were given by the individuals who partnered with us in that effort, and that's, from my perspective, why we got the quality piece we did, and the work you heard in the hour yesterday was out of all that partnership.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, would the author like to renew his motion?
Mr. Chair, members, and before I do so, let me very quickly extend a sincere and genuine request to all members of the committee on both sides of the aisle for advice and guidance. As I shared this morning, there are interrelated pieces here. and potential overlap because we heard Representative Winkler, Representative Demmer, we'll be hearing your bill concept on Friday, although the bill decides currently K-12 finance. There are several kind of similar things out there. Quite honestly, the chair is not quite sure yet what's the best way to hold those together and move those forward. And so I really do genuinely seek your advice on how to do that. I will most likely be here all weekend, so feel free to send me emails or even stop by. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I would renew my motion that we waive House File 1186 as amended on the table for layover for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Thank you. And thank you to the testifiers for being here late. I would like to note that this is the third professor of mine, Mr. Robichaux, who has been testifying here. I don't know if it should be flattery that my professors show up here or if it should be that Big Brother of Education is watching me. And I'm getting a little bit nervous now. And by the way, I still owe you a paper. Don't worry, the program isn't over yet, people. Representative Peterson, House File 1359.
Out of weariness, I try to keep brief.
The chair moves that House File 1359 be laid over for possible inclusion in the K-12 omnibus bill, and I believe you have an A2 amendment. Would you like to speak to that first?
Yes, I would, and it's just a clerical amendment, and it just specifies that it will be to high school students, and that the courses will be given to high school students. So, I would move that amendment.
Representative Peterson moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor, say aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion passes to your bill as amended.
Okay.
I think only one person said aye.
You're the only one counting. Okay. I will let our three guests introduce themselves in a very brief period of time. You know, I just thought I had to relate just a couple of scenarios before we get into this discussion, but there have been many times in my life when I have wished I had the ability to speak a foreign language. Probably none more significant than being in a barrio for a week in Nicaragua, and I and a friend who was with me in the house next door, our house or little building next door, were the only two non-Spanish-speaking people, and we were the only two English-speaking people, and there was a great divide. And it went fairly well with all of the actions until our second night there when she was bitten by a scorpion. And it was a small one, however. But neither of us knew how to relate this, what we considered an emergency, to the people who we were staying with. And they didn't need to talk, they didn't know how to talk to us, but somehow through books, etc., we were able to at least get out the information about a big sleep. And we weren't sure whether she was going to die before dawn or whether it was just a discussion about what the scorpion would do, what the effects would be. And so we stayed up all night and watched I watched her to see that she would be okay, etc. But that certainly was a significant piece in my life in terms of saying I need to be bilingual at least. And Spanish seemed to be the one that was probably in that case more prevalent, but I wished often that I could speak Italian or Chinese or maybe even Swedish. But it's very evident that it's much harder to learn when you get to be older and you haven't had it in school. The second scenario is in my own school district where we just had to close three schools. But one of the schools that we had to expand was our Spanish immersion, because we have numbers of students and parents who want to be part of the Spanish immersion program, which begins in kindergarten. We have waiting lists of folks who want their children in that kind of a program. I know that Edina has a French immersion because I have a step-granddaughter who's in that program in the kindergarten, and they absolutely think it's wonderful. I know that there are Chinese immersion in St. Paul, and Hmong immersion. We've got many different languages in terms of the immersion programs and the accessibility of students at very young ages to world languages. So this bill just says that our high school students as well will have the opportunity to have access as an elective to a world language program. And I think that in this day and age, that really is a necessity. And so our first testifier is right here. She will introduce herself.
Yeah, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anita Ratwick, a coordinator of Minnesota New Visions in Action in partnership with the Minnesota Council on the Teaching of Languages and Cultures. And I have to admit, after sitting here for these 3 hours, it's hard for me to go to my notes because I'd actually like to make some comments on things that have been said, including some stories that we all have as language teachers in other countries. It's always fun to compare and enjoy them. And I also have a whole bunch of research on world languages and world language teaching that I would love to donate to Representative Mariani's research center when that gets going. So having said that, I guess I will actually get back to the information I want to also pass on to you tonight. The 2009 Minnesota Legislative Report, Status of K-12 World Language Education in Minnesota, reveals the status of world languages in Minnesota's K-12 schools, which is similar to that of world languages in the late 1950s, over 50 years ago. Over the past 50 years, there have been many calls by national as well as by the state government, organizations, and current events calling for world language learning for all students and drawing attention to the increased need for world languages. Just over 50 years ago, in 1957, National Defense Education Act grew out of the response to Sputnik. 1998, A Nation at Risk followed. 1990, Minnesota's Profile of Learning included world languages as a required subject for high school graduation. 1995, Goal 2000 was made public, and Minnesota signed on to it. The response to September 11th has been similar to the aftermath following Sputnik. No Child Left Behind legislation includes foreign languages as one of the core subjects. Countless national educational organizations also call for all students to learn a world language. In spite of such major events and initiatives, barely 20% of Minnesota students today receive any world language learning. This figure includes all K-12 programs, including programs with the barest exposure to the language and culture, up to well-articulated K-12 programs offering sequences of 4, 5, or more years of language study. For today's students, learning a second language in this global age is more important than at any time in our history. It's important that the world language programs in our schools remain strong. The cognitive and academic benefits of learning a world language for all students have been shown in many studies, some of which are listed in your background material and packet, and I won't go on into those. We need to learn a diversity of languages for economic reasons, and that has become abundantly clear in the last few months as we realize how interdependent our economy is globally. No matter where you live in Minnesota, you've been touched by global business, whether that may be by the food you eat or the clothes you wear, the entertainment you enjoy, your hobbies, your interests, or how much your dollar will buy. We also need to learn a diversity of languages for our national security. The late U.S. Senator Paul Simon said, in every national crisis from the Cold War through Vietnam, Desert Storm, Bosnia, and Kosovo, our nation has lamented its foreign language shortfalls. But then the crisis goes away and we return to business as usual. One of the messages of September 11th is that business as usual is no longer an exceptional option. Says the late U.S. Senator Paul Simon. So what would this bill do? This bill will restore the requirement that school districts offer a minimum of 2 years of high school equivalent coursework in a world language, increasing the requirement to 3 years of high school equivalent coursework by the school year 2015-2016, 7 years from now. Minnesota school districts were required by statute to offer 2 years of a single language until 1990, when Area Canada Profile of Learning made world languages a high school graduation requirement. The profile was later tabled and then thrown out. Since that time, Minnesota statute requires school districts to develop curriculum standards for world languages. They are also required to offer world languages as an elective. Over the past 6 or 7 years, many world language programs have been cut or reduced. Restoring the earlier world language statute would help stabilize world language programs. Offering 2 years or more of language is the norm, the status quo now. The MDE 2009 district survey, the respondents showed only 3 public schools and 5 charter schools offering only 1 year of world language. 36 districts offered only 2 years. All the other responding districts indicated that they were already offering 3 or more years of language. For the districts who wish to increase what they offer, there are options. Obviously, we prefer a teacher on the basis there. That can be very hard for some districts to actually do, in part because there's so few. I'll touch that later on. Some of the options include online learning, distance learning, PSEO, and working with your neighboring district. There are options out there that are cost effective. Districts are expected to provide their students with the education they need to thrive in the future and to have the skills necessary to be successful in credit-bearing college-level classes. While 2 years does not accomplish that, it is a beginning that districts seem to have chosen to maintain as a minimum. The MinSCU and other colleges and universities require 2 years of a world language for admission. 2 years of a language for students going to college has been a rule of thumb for over 100 years. It predates flight. It hardly reflects the reality of the global world of the 21st century, but it would provide stability to current programs and encourage more students to go into teaching world languages. World language teachers are identified as a field with critical shortages at the national level and at the state level. In 2004, 99 Minnesota students completed licensure to teach world languages. 44 added the licensure to an elementary or a 712 license. In 2008, 4 years later, that number had plummeted to 33 and 3 respectively. 36 new teachers is too few to even meet the needs of our current program. As teachers retire, we need to replace them with strong teachers, able to retain students and get them to high levels of proficiency. We have had many conversations with school superintendents and school board members at our booth at the Minnesota School Board's annual conference in January. They frequently mention how hard it is to find teachers, especially those from Greater Minnesota. This is also reflected in the 2009 MDE report, Teacher Supply and Demand. The cuts to world language programs in the past 6 or 7 years and ongoing cuts, we just heard of another 2 districts who are trying to cut their programs yesterday. It leads to job insecurity, making it especially difficult to recruit new teachers. This bill would help that. Minnesota needs to support world languages. This bill will help to support and develop rigorous coursework for our students, so our students will eventually approach what their peers around the world can already do today. To talk about a world-class education without including needed levels of world languages and cultures is an illusion. We propose this legislation as a means to address the needs in a manner realistic for school districts and with a vision toward growing the state's capacity to teach and learn world languages. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ratwick, for that complete testimony, we'd ask that the other two testifiers make sure that you add new conversation within that so that we can try and keep the testimony to, well, we got to come back here in less than 11 hours. So.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Kim Miller. I work with the Center for Advanced Research on Language Acquisition at the University of Minnesota. And I'm speaking here today from the perspective of the language immersion community, which Representative Peterson referred to earlier. We currently have 49 language immersion programs in the state of Minnesota in French, German, Spanish, Chinese, Ojibwe, and Dakota. A language immersion is not your traditional kind of foreign language learning or world language learning. It is a combination of language learning and content learning, typically starting in kindergarten. Why would we as immersion educators be interested in this bill, which is confined to 2 to 3 years of a language in high school? Here's why. Because we see a passage of this bill as an important step toward embracing second language learning in Minnesota in a more comprehensive manner. Governor Pawlenty, who is currently the chair of the Education Commission of the states, has publicly stated that the states have led the way in embracing higher standards, innovation, and increased accountability. Perhaps he has then heard about and supports a recently announced initiative by the state of Utah, who will be hiring a statewide immersion coordinator to work alongside a world language specialist. And what is their mandate? Over the next 5 years, they will be opening 100 new immersion programs. 21 will be opened in the fall of 2009. 8 in Mandarin, 8 in Spanish, and 5 in French, and that's in Utah. We also support this bill because it will send a signal to school districts all over the state that Minnesotans value their children's acquisition of a second language as an essential component of the kind of education that will prepare them, and I quote Pawlenty again as his role as the chair of the Education Commission, for the hyper-competitive global world we live in. We also support the bill because it will send a signal to college students that becoming highly proficient in a second language opens opportunities for them not only in traditional high school language teaching, but in immersion schools as well. And finally, we support the passage of this bill because it's an important move toward recognizing the power of a language-enriched education to prepare students who can potentially function at a high level of bilingual proficiency, can compete successfully with their peers on standardized tests, which are taken in English, and as some new research is beginning to show, may even begin to close the achievement gap. Thank you.
Thank you. State your name for the record, and please give us your testimony.
Hi. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and the committee, for staying so late to listen to us. I'm Betty Lauterman. I'm a teacher, licensed teacher of German and Spanish for the Moundsview High School, Moundsview Public School District, where I've taught for the last 20 years. I have a master's in Hispanic linguistics from the University of Minnesota. I've served on the board of the Minnesota American Association for Teachers of Spanish and Portuguese and the Minnesota Council of Teachers of Foreign Language, and I'm a national board certified teacher. And over my teaching career, I have taught everything from level 1 to level 5 AP. I graduated in 1969 from Edgerton. I don't know how many of you know Minnesota's geography, but it's way down there in the southwest corner. It's a very rural district. We had a very small high school, 60 members of my graduating class, and I had 3 years of German. It was really that third year of German that sparked my interest in learning a language. The first 2 years were pretty ho-hum, but when we got to the third year, we started to read literature in German. That's when I really said, wow, this is exciting, and I went on in college to study German. Went to Germany to get a summer job, and, you know, my life went on from there.
So I have a very passionate belief that all children, even in rural districts, and it's often said, well, in these rural districts, we really can't be affording to offer, you know, this kind of course offering. I just have a passionate belief. What would have happened to me if I didn't have the opportunity to take 3 years of German in high school? So our rural kids, our urban kids, all kids need the opportunity to get an education that will allow them to fully participate in the world economy. So this bill just really kind of takes us back to the 60s to offer kids today the same thing that kids in the 60s were being offered at a time when the term global economy wasn't even in our vocabulary. World language education can be expanded even in tough economic times. Moundsview Public Schools is a district going through declining enrollment, therefore has severe budget restrictions, but we did significantly broaden our world language program this year. The board began to work with the teachers of the district because they wanted to expand offerings. They began with an assumption that it had to be cost neutral. We also worked with the Minnesota Department of Education, the coordinator of world languages, Jan Kitchoff, and thanks to some of the members of this committee who worked very hard to get us a world language coordinator at the Department of Education, because it helps districts like ours when they want to increase their offerings. They have someone to go to say, well, how do we do this? Next year we will be offering an elementary program, which we did not have at all. In grades 4 and 5, we will be offering a middle school program, which we did not have at all. And we will add Chinese to our world language offerings of French, German, Spanish, and American Sign Language. So it can be done, even in tough economic times. Language offerings can be expanded if districts have the will to do so. Why move to 3 years rather than the 2 years in 2015-2016? It's really, you really have to start before the college level. If you're going to, for example, meet someone who can go on to teach in the language, they have to come to college with a working knowledge of the language. Otherwise, it simply can't be done in 4 years of college to produce a teacher, for example. You can't produce anyone who has a language ability high enough to be useful in the workplace if they don't come to college with a good beginning in learning that language. In order to do well in the placement exams, in the MinSkew system, in the University of Minnesota, they require at least 3 years of high school language. So these are some reasons why it's very important to go to the 3-year standard. So, we would hope that school districts would offer much more. But this is really a requirement for the 21st century that at least this level of world language offering be available to every student in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Question from members. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Peterson or any of you testifiers, do you know how many of our school districts currently are offering foreign language? And I assume you're just talking about the high school level now. And I know that many school districts, including Eden Prairie, we recently have a Spanish immersion school and have some language exposure beginning in fifth grade formally. But how many districts do have it, and how many would already be doing probably in excess of what you're proposing?
I think we'll see, and I'll let her testify in a moment, but I think the concern was that most of the schools now offer some foreign language, but with many of the cuts that have occurred, etc., there's tending to be a decline in the number of schools.
And Mr. Chair, committee, of the survey respondents, which was the vast majority of the districts in the state, there were three public schools
and 5 charter schools that were only offering 1 year. There were 36 that were offering 2 years, and all the rest of the school districts were offering already 3 or more levels of language. So we're talking about a very, very small percentage at this point from the responders that were offering, that would have to expand their offering.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is for Ms. Miller. You mentioned very briefly that there was a research or some kind of study that was starting to indicate a narrowing of the achievement gap related to language studies. I'm curious, you don't need to go into it here necessarily, even, but if you could just point us to that study, I'd be real curious to see.
Yes,
that.
I do have something. I have a few copies of something I could hand out. But yes, there has been, it's still fairly new. There has been some work in Louisiana, which has a network of French immersion schools that is showing some interesting results with regard to standardized testing. And then in California, there is also some work being done in particular with two-way immersion schools where students who are native English speakers and students who are speakers of another language, usually Spanish, are schooled together. And we're finding that those native Spanish-speaking students, that is one of, if not the best situation, best environment for them to start achieving high enough to be able to close that gap. Preliminary results, but it's looking good.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at line 1.13, and it says 2 academic years of high school level world languages. So does that mean you have to offer at least two different languages for 2 years in each language? Is that the way that I would interpret that?
Mr. Chair, Representative McFarland, no. You have to offer 2 years of a language.
Then should that be plural for languages then on that line, or should it say language?
Mr. Chair, Representative McFarland, the reason that we continually use languages is because we want to emphasize the need for a diversity of language, not just a language. And it is right now within the state, it's predominantly Spanish. We feel very strongly that we need the diversity of language, so that's why we keep saying languages. But that does not mean, I mean, the statute is for 2 years of a language.
I guess I'm just wondering if this language is going to be interpreted with the intent that it has.
Mr. Chair, I'm...
Representative Peterson?
Ms. Larson shaking her head. I'm not sure what that means. What do you think the language should read?
She has notes, so I think she does have some questions about the language.
Mr. Chairman, members, I wonder if it would be helpful to clarify the intent for Representative McFarland's question on both lines 1.13 and 1.14, after of and before high, insert sequential, so that there's some notice or some understanding that there are a sequence of these courses. So on page 1, line 13, after of, insert sequential, and on page 1, line 14, after of, insert sequential.
Representative Peterson?
Mr. Chair, it seems to be acceptable to our experts here, and so it's fine with me.
So you'd like to move the oral amendment?
I would move that oral amendment, sorry.
All right, any discussion? Those in favor, please say aye. Oh, sorry, Ms. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McFarland.
I guess that I understand where you're coming from on that. Now, if a person took 1 year of French and 1 year of Spanish, is that going to work under that analogy?
It's about what's offered, yeah, versus what they take. Yeah.
That was driving on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was questioning right along that same line. Is this ensuring that the student has access to 2 years of sequential same language, or does it say that the district or the school must offer one language for 2 years, and if that student happens to get in there at the right year, they're in 2 years? I think there's a little confusion as to whether the student has to have access to 2 years of a language, or if a school just offers 2 years and they can choose whichever 2 years, 9th and 10th grade, 11th and 12th, that they've satisfied the intent.
Members, we are laying this over so we can, with Representative Peterson, we can move to change some language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll work with Ms. Larson to get this. I understand what you're saying, and we'll work to get the language clarified.
Would you like to remove your oral amendment?
I will do that. I will remove that one.
Thank you. Withdraw it.
Withdraw it.
Okay. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I couldn't resist to ask one more question. I'm interested in the idea of, and I'm not sure who to address this to, but it just occurred to me that, you know, there's a lot of language work being done in all the elementary schools and the earlier grades, and I think we've even heard testimony someplace in the past that maybe that's the best time for them to learn a world language. It's interesting that we're directing that we have it in high school. Could I just get a comment about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, we strongly, strongly urge world language learning begin at the elementary level. We would love it. That's where our passion is in terms of starting K-12 sequence. That's what we need. But the reality is that it's particularly in greater Minnesota and in urban Minnesota, elementary programs are almost non-existent. And we wanted to get some type of a floor so that we weren't losing any more languages, any more programs, and so that we could continue to build up. But yes, anything that would, you know, and the five model programs that went through 2 years ago were all elementary programs. That was obviously part of our dream and part of the wish, part of our vision for world languages down the road would be starting in the elementary level as they do throughout the world.
Representative Demmer?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I need to put in a little plug here. My daughter was a teacher. We've talked about this in the Russell Tyler Rustin School District, not this year, but the prior 2 years, and she taught elementary Spanish K-3. And so they are doing that out there, and not because they have a large Hispanic or Latino population or anything like that, but I thought it was very interesting. It was very unique, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, I can find this out through research, I suppose, but I think they're under some sort of a pilot program with their kids. But I thought it was an interesting concept. It was just a half hour with all the kids every day. So very interesting.
Thank you. Any other discussion or questions for members?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we included this in the packet. This is our sesquicentennial grant project. So thank you for the grant from the legislature. But our grant project was gathering information, many languages, many voices, one state, their legacy, past and present. This explained the original project, but students from South High School submitted these posters, and we thought they were so neat that they had to have a life beyond just the year of the sesquicentennial. And that's when we came up with the idea of the calendar. So these posters are really neat. The text that goes along with it describes languages in Minnesota from the past 150 plus years. And it kind of gives you the understanding of how we are intertwined with the people speaking all these different languages, and where the function of language in the past 150 years really hasn't even changed that much. What has changed is the context from talking in it. Well, my mother grew up speaking Swedish until she started school. The neighbor on the farm across the road, which happens to be where the Vikings training ground is now, spoke Czech. The function of language hasn't changed that much from then to now. What has changed is the size of the neighborhood. And as we think about languages and language learning, that always illustrates to me the difference between the 21st century and 100 years ago. So enjoy the calendar, but that's the reason behind the calendar. So.
Thank you. And I believe that Mr. Schneiderwin with the MSBA would like to come down and make a few comments.
Does he speak a foreign language?
What's that?
What do you like?
Swedish. All testimony from here on out must be in his foreign language.
Yo hablo español un poquito.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kirk Schneider, I'm with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I realize it's late, and I just want to, you know, I think you guys can probably anticipate where I'm going to go with this, and I think it's an issue that, you know, this is coming from a guy who loves world languages and world culture, but for all our school districts, we need to understand the complexity, and there's some value in the elected courses piece. I mean, there's some inherent learning piece that goes along with that, and I applaud her, the author, for carrying this thing out into the future 4 years, but you know, as I learned, it's harder to get things out when they're already in law than they are to try to fix them before that, and there's a lot of truth to that, and I think as you go forward with this consideration here, that you need to look at the flexibility and look at how much we're requiring of our high schools to complete, not only in the world languages, but also in the math and science, where the STEM initiative is pushing forward. So I just think you need to make sure that if this is a one-size-fits-all, that all our school districts are going to be able to make these offerings for our students. excuse me. And the reality that if we have to go through this, that means that we're hiring additional teachers. Now it's not a big issue, or now it would be a more dire situation, but out in the future, we understand that things can hopefully get better. So I just want to raise those issues for you.
Any other questions from members? Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would only reiterate what the previous speaker said, and that is there are many ways for schools to access these courses, and they're elective. They can be online, PSEO, and actually in the Robbinsville School District that I come from at Armstrong High School 2 years ago, the teacher of the year was a man who taught Japanese, and he wasn't from the Robbinsville District. He was from District 287, Intermediate District, which is a consortium of districts, and he offered that class in the high school, and pretty soon he was teaching five classes because he was such a dynamic teacher, and he was so good at what he did, and it was an elective. There are many ways to access those classes without having to have a teacher on site or hire new people. And I think we can be creative in our schools to offer that as an elective of some sort. And with that, I renew my motion to put this on the floor for consideration.
And I believe the original motion was to lay it over for possible inclusion in the K-12 Omnibus Bill. And with that, we are adjourned.